This audiobook is entitled A Global Security System, An Alternative to War, the 5th edition. It contains 7 chapters and a conclusion. It was originally authored by Kent Shifford, Patrick Hiller, and David Swanson, edited by Tony Jenkins and Phil Gittins, narration by Tim Pluta. Summary. Resting on a convincing body of evidence that violence is not a necessary component of conflict among states and between states and non-state actors, World Beyond War asserts that war itself can be ended. We humans have lived without war for most of our existence, and most people live without war most of the time. Warfare arose about 10,000 years ago. Only 5% of our existence as Homo sapiens, and spawned a vicious cycle as peoples, fearing attack by militarized states, found it necessary to imitate them. And so began the cycle of violence that has culminated in the last 100 years in a condition of perma-war. War now threatens to destroy civilization as weapons have become ever more destructive. However, in the last 150 years, revolutionary new knowledge and methods of nonviolent conflict management have been developing that lead us to assert that it is time to end warfare, and that we can do so by mobilizing millions around a global effort. Here, you will find the pillars of war which must be taken down so that the whole edifice of the war system can collapse. And here are the foundations of peace, already being laid, on which we will build a world where everyone will be safe. This book presents a comprehensive blueprint for peace as the basis of an action plan to finally end war. How this book is organized and how to use it. This book begins with a provocative vision of peace, which may seem to some to be utopian until one reads the rest of the book, which comprises the means for achieving it. The first two parts of the book present an analysis of how the current war system works, the desirability and necessity of replacing it, and an analysis of why doing this is possible. The next part outlines the Alternative Global Security System, or AGSS, that challenges the failed system of national security and replaces it with the concept of common security. No one is safe until all are safe. The AGSS relies on 3 broad strategies for humanity to end war. 1. Demilitarizing security. 2. Managing conflicts without violence. And 3. Creating a culture of peace. These are the interrelated components of our system. The frameworks, processes, tools, and institutions necessary for dismantling the war machine and replacing it with a peace system that will provide a more assured, common security. Strategies for demilitarizing security are directed at reducing dependency on militarism. At first glance, these strategies seem to be only focused on undoing the present system. However, they also establish normative principles for pursuing and achieving security. Strategies for managing conflict without violence are focused on reforming and/or establishing new institutions, tools, and processes for assuring security. These are the most outwardly functional components of our system. Strategies for creating a culture of peace are the most visionary, potentially transformative, and future-oriented. These strategies are concerned with establishing social and cultural norms, values, and principles necessary for sustaining a thriving peace system and the means to spread it globally. The remainder of the book addresses realistic steps an individual or group can take, highlighting the efforts of World Beyond War to accelerate the transition, and ending with a resource guide for further study and action. This book is an essential learning tool for those curious about and committed to the abolition of war. It is also an invaluable resource for policy recommendations and citizen action for a more peaceful world order. It is designed for personal study, group discussion, and/or classroom use. We encourage you to read it from cover to cover, although you may also easily jump in at any point. AGSS is a dynamic, living resource. While we have documented here significant research and experimentation on alternative approaches to security, and our knowledge and experiences continues to expand rapidly, we are still confronted by a dominating war system. New thinking and knowledge must be continually developed, so we invite you to treat this as a shared project. As you explore the alternative vision presented here, you are encouraged to formulate your own ideas on the most effective and ethically consistent strategies and institutions as the foundations of a global security system. We also firmly believe that by encouraging learners to formulate their own solutions and map out systems for common security, we are more likely to encourage ownership and political action to bring the new system into being. Citizen action is absolutely essential for the transformation of the present system. So, beyond assessing the alternatives presented, we invite you to consider and share with us the actions we might take as individuals or collectively to advance possibilities for change. As noted above, while this book is based on the work of many experts in peace research, political science, and international relations, as well as on the experience of many activists, it is an evolving plan that will change as we gain more and more experience. The challenges outlined in the first part are real, interconnected, and tremendous. Sometimes we don't make the connections because we don't see them. Sometimes we simply bury our heads in the sand. The problems are too big, too overwhelming, too uncomfortable. The bad news is that the problems won't go away if we ignore them. The good news is that there is reason for authentic hope. The historic end of war is now possible. If we muster the will to act and to save ourselves and the planet from ever greater catastrophe, World Beyond War firmly believes that we can do this. Study war no more. Join our online learning community. Study War No More is our free online learning guide designed to support further study of this book. Developed in partnership with the Global Campaign for Peace Education, the guide can be used for independent study or as a tool for facilitating dialogue and discussion in classrooms and with community groups. Study War No More presents several difficult topics, each featuring guiding questions to support deeper inquiry of essential topics. Study War No More also helps to bring this book to life. Each discussion topic includes an introductory video from one of our study and action partners, leading global thinkers, strategists, academics, advocates, and activists who are already developing components of an alternative global security system. Some of these study and action partners will be introduced throughout this book. Preface to the 5th edition. A lot has happened since the 4th edition of A Global Security System, AGSS, was published in 2018. Crises, such as the coronavirus disease pandemic, not only produced major economic and social consequences, but also led to a wider discussion about what we depend on to keep us safe. This discussion deepened with time as more people realized what many already knew, that militaries cannot make us secure, that in fact, they endanger us. In moments of crisis, the seemingly impossible can become possible. The good news is that the ever-present worldwide efforts for peace are calling for increased international cooperation, enforcement of approved laws regarding peace, and many other changes reflecting the long-standing and continuing shift from warfare toward healthcare. One of the most promising for the purposes of this book is the call for a global ceasefire, which creates the conditions upon which lasting peace can be built. We need to develop a maximum commitment to ensure that the vision of a global ceasefire prevails, to help quell the overlapping and intersecting crises of wars, massive displacement of civilians, climate collapse, and the risk of nuclear catastrophe. The crises related to war and nuclear war have not yet been given even the attention received by other crises facing us. Changing this dynamic is all the more relevant if we are to survive and thrive as a species. All of this makes the central message of this book both timely and timeless. If we are to meet the needs of societies during the current and future crises, then we have to update our notions and practices of security. This calls for a rethinking of society, one that is globally inclusive and transforms our failed economic system into something that is capable of guiding our recovery through uncharted territory and improving lives. The pages that follow outline the relevancy and indeed urgency for shifting resources away from military-related activities toward meeting basic needs that keep people and the planet safe, secure, and healthy. A job that war does not do. As before, the book is presented as a work in progress to which readers are encouraged to contribute. The present book is organized in the same way as the fourth edition, and the previous preface still applies. The focus is still on the articulation of a blueprint for peace as the basis of an action plan and finally end of war. In this edition, there are revisions throughout. Some revisions include adding or extending examples, making minor changes, incorporating new data, and bringing in new empirical research to support the arguments made. There are new topics covered in this edition that were not addressed in previous editions. These include feminist foreign policy, infrastructures for peace, and the role of youth in peace and security. We invited Patrick Hiller and Saul R. Best to contribute to this effort. Patrick is one of the original authors of the book and serves as the executive director of the War Prevention Initiative. He is involved in work with the Center for Feminist Foreign Policy, and for this reason we invited him to write the new entry on feminist foreign policy. Saul, as co-founder of the Global Alliance for Ministries and Infrastructures for Peace, GAMIP, and the Canadian Peace Initiative, CPI, is ideally placed to reflect on work around infrastructures for peace. We are immensely indebted to Patrick and Saul for their contributions. The new material on the role of youth in peace and security is written by the editor of this edition, who has extensive experience in working with young people in a range of different contexts and settings. These new editions can be read independently of each other and of the book as a whole, but what ties them together is a common commitment to the essential nature of inclusivity in peacebuilding. We decided to include this new material at the end of the book, just before the appendices. This is done to avoid tampering with the text and to help readers find the new material quickly and easily. These new entries are responsive to emerging trends in the field and add several important tools to the discussion on how the peacebuilding community is evolving to meet new challenges. To this end, while acknowledging that these new entries, as with other entries in the book, could be integrated within the AGSS framework in different places and might overlap in different ways, for purposes of clarity and a place to start, we chose to situate them within the framework where we did. We also wish to acknowledge the many people who have helped in shaping this book. We thank and applaud World Beyond War chapters and affiliates who continue to reflect upon and experiment with many of the ideas contained in this book. We hope this text will help to shed a light on the work they continue to do to advance the prospects for ending war and, above all, encourage others to join in this collective endeavor. Thanks are also due to those who read the previous edition of the book and provided valuable feedback on it. We hope that we have done justice to some of your concerns and comments. We also wish to thank participants on our intensive online courses. Some of the inspiration for the revisions emerged as a result of helpful comments and critical remarks. It is hoped that this book will provide some help as we all continue to learn about and take action toward ending the scourge of war and advancing peace in the world. To help do this, we offer the contents of this book as a portion of the increasingly important foundation of peace education and as a call to action, with suggestions on how to unite our efforts to abolish war. Preface to the 2018-2019 edition. This fourth edition of World Beyond War's Blueprint for Ending War represents another dynamic evolution in our thinking about what comprises a global security system and the strategies, new models, and visions necessary for getting us there. This book guides our work and has emboldened members of our community to become active participants and change makers who are challenging the old system and laying the foundations for the new. Each year, we invite and encourage feedback on a global security system, an alternative to war, henceforth AGSS, with the hope and intention of clarifying our vision and making the blueprint easier to follow. Much of our feedback this year came from participants in our intensive online courses, many of whom found it challenging to visualize and articulate the whole system. The necessary complexity of a system framework of this scope can lead to confusion. Thus, this edition takes on this call for clarity. Many of the changes you'll find in these pages are structural. Some parts have been moved so as to be more logically situated within the framework, and a few redundancies have been deleted. Most significant in our attempt at clarity is the addition of a summary chart outlining the components and strategies of AGSS, as well as a mind map flowchart that should aid readers in visualizing the interrelationships amongst all the dynamic parts of the system. New to this edition are short executive summaries to each of the three main components and guiding strategies described in the outline of our system. These summaries help illustrate the strategic balance sought between transitionary reforms to existing security efforts and more transformative proposals advocating for the development of new approaches and institutions. These summaries are also complemented by strategic policy and action recommendations. This edition was prompted by a story shared by a community member who had the opportunity to give a copy of AGSS to a U.S. Congresswoman. The Congresswoman's office found AGSS powerful, yet too dense for the average lawmaker. These new recommendations distill some of what we believe to be the most critical policy recommendations to be pursued. These recommendations are also focused calls to action, guiding suggestions for political engagement for all concerned. Another challenge of visualizing AGSS is that many find it difficult to imagine something that has yet to come into being. As with past editions, we share stories of hope and change that illuminate the undocumented and unprecedented peace revolution of modern times. A revolution that is overshadowed by the predominant culture narrative of militarism. We attempt to breathe a bit more life into these stories by introducing the work of many of our study and action partners, leading global thinkers, strategists, academics, advocates, and activists who are already developing components of an alternative global security system. These partners were previously introduced on Study War No More, our complimentary free online learning guide designed to support further study of this book. We share snippets of their stories here with links to video interviews found on Study War No More. The section on proposals for starting over, alternative approaches to humane global governance, has also had a major overhaul. We haven't entirely given up on the United Nations, but we recognize its many faults, many of which may be too difficult to overcome under the present nation-state paradigm. We continue to call for strategic reforms of the current system, but we also believe it's essential to rethink the entire paradigm of global governance. World Beyond War recently drafted a new framework for a Global Emergency Assembly, or GEA, a vision for an institution of global governance designed to replace the current UN system. We complement our synopsis of GEA, a work in progress, with a broader introduction to the Earth Federation and the Earth Constitution. These efforts go back to 1958, when the World Constitution and Parliament Association was founded to promote the principles of global democratic governance. We think these proposals represent some of the most promising visions and models for peaceful global governance and share them with the hopes that they will spur much-needed new thinking and potentially influence reforms to existing institutions. As with past editions, we strive to incorporate new and updated data to more accurately illustrate current trends. The contributions from peace research are growing, and whenever possible, we integrate empirical evidence from analyses in the Peace Science Digest to support many of the arguments made. In addition, research institutions like the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, the Peace Research Institute Oslo, the Institute for Economics and Peace, or One Earth Future Research, provide data on military spending, business and security, gender and security, peacefulness or lack thereof, and empirically based actionable strategies and policy recommendations. We know that we might not sufficiently address all emerging security concerns. For instance, we could easily dedicate an entire volume to address the dilemmas of Trumpism. However, truth be told, Donald Trump's escalatory rhetoric hardly represents a new tack in U.S. foreign diplomacy or security policy. While we continue to resist all current and new wars, the mission of World Beyond War and AGSS is to end all wars, a more long-term strategic endeavor. We hope this updated edition provides opportunities for new learning, new outreach, and new partnerships that might aid us in moving beyond the choir with our efforts and connect the disconnected. We hope that other movement builders, such as our study and action partners, will continue to engage in the critical work of building components of the new system, as well as identify areas of focus and unity based on developments and insights highlighted in this book. A guiding vision of peace. There are many different visions of peace. The following is ours. A sustainable future world in which children live free from fear and violence, are nurtured by a culture of peace, and are able to achieve their full human potential is what motivates World Beyond War's efforts to establish an alternative global security system. This is what we are striving for. The system we establish should be moving us in that direction. If not, we need to reconsider our design. What is your guiding vision of peace? What vision motivates you to take action for change? We will know we have achieved peace when the world is safe for all children. They will play freely out of doors, never worry about picking up cluster bombs or about drones buzzing overhead. There will be good education for all children for as far as they are able to go. Schools will be safe and free from fear. The economy will be healthy, producing useful things rather than those things which destroy use value, and producing them in ways that are sustainable. There will be no carbon-burning industry, and global warming will have been halted. All children will study peace and will be trained in powerful, peaceful methods of confronting violence, should it arise at all. Children will learn how to diffuse and resolve conflicts peacefully. When they grow up, they may enlist in a Shanti Sena, a peace force that will be trained in the unarmed protection of civilians and perfect the use of civilian-based defense, making their nations ungovernable if attacked by another country or a coup d'etat, and therefore immune from conquest. Children will be healthy because healthcare will be freely available. funded from the vast sums that once were spent on the war machine. The air and water will be clean, soils healthy and producing healthy food, because the funding for ecological restoration will be available from the same source. When we see children playing, we will see children from many different cultures together at their play, because restrictive borders will have been abolished. The arts will flourish, and science will focus on constructive rather than destructive ways to create safety and prosperity. While learning to be proud of their own cultures, their religions, arts, foods, traditions, etc., these children will realize they are citizens of one small planet, as well as citizens of their respective countries. They will grow up with respect for democratically agreed upon international law. These children will never be soldiers, although they may well serve humanity in voluntary organizations or in some kinds of universal service for the common good. No one is safe until all are safe. Chapter 1. Introduction. A Blueprint for Ending War. Peace educator Patricia M. Misch once wrote, "Whatever purpose the war system might once have served, it has now become dysfunctional to future human survival." Yet, it has not been abolished. In On Violence, Hannah Arendt wrote that the reason warfare is still with us is not a death wish of our species, nor some instinct of aggression, but the simple fact that no substitute for this final arbiter in international affairs has yet appeared on the political scene. The alternative global security system we describe here is the substitute. It rejects the failed system of national security and replaces it with the concept of common security. No one is safe until all are safe. The goal of this book is to gather into one place everything one needs to know to work toward an end to war by replacing it with an alternative global security system, one in which peace is pursued by peaceful means. The path to ending war and establishing the alternative global security system can be achieved through three broad strategies. 1. Demilitarizing security. 2. Managing conflicts without violence. And 3. Creating a culture of peace. These three strategies are the organizing components of our blueprint. For nearly all of recorded history, we have studied war and how to win it. But war has become ever more destructive and now threatens whole populations and planetary ecosystems with annihilation in a nuclear holocaust. Short of that, it brings conventional destruction unimaginable only a generation ago, while looming global economic and environmental crises go unattended. Unwilling to give in to such a negative end to our human story, we have begun to react in positive ways. We have begun to study war with a new purpose, to end it, by replacing it with a system of conflict management that will result, at the very least, in a minimal peace. This document is a blueprint for ending war. It is not a plan for an ideal utopia. It is a summary of the work of many, based on many years of experience and analysis by people striving to understand why, when almost everyone wants peace, we still have wars. And on the work of countless people who have real-world political experience in nonviolent struggle as a substitute for war. Many of these people have come together to work with World Beyond War. The work of World Beyond War. World Beyond War is helping build a global nonviolent movement to end war and establish a just and sustainable peace. We believe the time is right for large-scale cooperation among existing civil society organizations seeking peace, justice, human rights, sustainability, and other benefits to humanity. We believe that the overwhelming majority of the world's people are sick of war and ready to back a global movement to replace it with a system of conflict management that does not kill masses of people, exhaust resources, or degrade the planet. World Beyond War believes that conflict between nations and within nations will always exist, and that it is all too frequently militarized with disastrous results for all sides. We believe that humanity can create, and already is in the process of creating, a non-militarized alternative global security system that will resolve and transform conflicts without resort to violence. We also believe that such a system will need to be phased in while phasing out militarized security. Hence, we advocate such measures as non-provocative defense and international peacekeeping in the early stages of the changeover. We are confident that viable alternatives to war can and will be constructed. We do not believe we have described a perfect system. This is a work in progress that we invite others to improve. Nor do we believe that such an alternative system might not fail in limited ways. However, we are confident that such a system will not fail people in the massive ways that the current war system does. And we also provide means of reconciliation and a return to peace should such limited failures occur. You will see here the elements of an alternative global security system that does not rely on war or the threat of war. These elements include many for which people have long been working, sometimes for generations: the abolition of nuclear weapons, reform of the United Nations, ending the use of drones, changing national priorities from wars and preparation for war to meeting human and environmental needs, and many others. World Beyond War intends to cooperate fully with these efforts while mobilizing a mass movement to end war and replace it with an alternative global security system. You can learn more about our current efforts by reading the section Accelerating the Transition, Building the World Beyond War Movement. Disclaimer: World Beyond War is a global movement. Dismantling the war system and replacing it with an alternative global security system requires us to adopt new thinking that goes beyond borders and to abandon many of the old mindsets about world order that divide rather than unite us. We therefore strive in this publication to offer a full integration of international, national, cultural, and gendered understandings and experiences. We acknowledge that much of the analysis in this book is focused on U.S. military and foreign policy. Of course, U.S. militarism is felt throughout the world through military, economic, cultural, and political domination. The United States is a big part of the problem, but not the full problem. In our transition to becoming a truly global movement, we seek to bring attention to the pervasiveness of militarism and war in every corner of the planet, as well as integrate more non-Western approaches to peacebuilding and security. We hope that over time, this book will reflect a greater diversity of perspectives through our continued effort to seek and integrate your feedback. It will require a truly global movement to succeed in our mission to abolish war. You are invited to help build this movement. Why an alternative global security system is necessary. Modern history is so vivid in detail about warfare that we tend to assume that war is an attribute of humanity itself. American anthropologist Margaret Mead famously observed that warfare is not in our genes, that it is, in fact, a human invention. Not only is there no scientific evidence of genetic predispositions to war, there is no viable anthropological evidence to suggest that our hunter-gathering ancestors ever engaged in war-making activities. In 1986, a group of scientists gathered in Seville, Spain, to once and for all put the mythical notion of humanity's innate warlike nature to bed. they produced the Seville Statement on Violence that challenges and refutes the many excuses of biological determinism that are often used to justify going to war. Margaret Mead argued that war is a culturally learned behavior. She explains this by observing that if a people have an idea of going to war, and the idea that war is the way in which certain situations defined within their society are to be handled, they will sometimes go to war. So, if war is indeed a human invention, what are we to do about it? War is part of our thoughts and is immortalized in culture through education and military monuments in town squares. Mead argues that other social inventions have faded away. But for this to happen, two conditions must be met. One, we must recognize the defects of the old invention. And two, we must make a new one to replace it. Regarding the first condition, we are well aware of the defects of war. Indeed, there are no upsides. This introductory section of our blueprint explores these failings. The second condition is the focus of the rest of the book. With what do we replace the war system? What alternatives currently exist that are more preferred than the ones presently used? Which must still be imagined? And once we have a clear vision of a peace system to replace the war system, how might we go about facilitating the transition from the old to the new? What must we know? And what skills will we need to build it? What political and practical strategies might we employ? What's our role in this transition? Margaret Mead also alluded to a third condition that must be met for old inventions to fade away. We need to have the belief that social invention is possible. Getting past the pessimism that the war system imbues within us is no easy task. Futurists are keen to point out that it's difficult to imagine and construct preferred realities when our visions of the future are guided by present probabilities. The present system is so stark that a negative future seems predestined. Such a worldview shapes our thinking about what is possible. We have to shake off the humanly invented chains of the war system and militarism that shapes our thinking if we are to move from probable to preferred future realities. In this task, it's helpful to remember the provocative words of pioneering peace researcher Kenneth Boulding. Whatever exists is possible. Thinking that war is inevitable makes it so. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Thinking that ending war is possible opens the door to constructive work on an actual peace system. What makes us secure? Security, particularly national security, unfortunately is defined in relation to military power and its global projection. It is necessary to shift from an anarchic state system security paradigm to one that reflects human and planetary needs. The traditional focus of security thinking has emphasized the nation-state and competition for power in the international system. While it is widely recognized that the understanding of security needs to be broadened, immense fiscal resources still are put toward building stronger militaries. The term security dilemma is an anarchic global system of states is described as follows. According to the security dilemma, actions taken by one state to enhance its security will necessarily decrease the security of other states. By acting to defend itself, a state may inadvertently provoke aggressive reactions from its rivals. The real security dilemma, however, lies at the intersection of an outdated security through strength paradigm and a new security paradigm emphasizing human and planetary needs. The far-flung U.S. military establishment, including hundreds of military bases scattered around the world, will not save civilization. It belongs to another era. Earth Policy Institute Lester Brown wrote that. The old paradigm. The legacy of two world wars and the Cold War in the last century keeps us stuck to defining security almost exclusively through military force. The military security lens is not only visible in peace through strength language, but also easily quantifiable in budgetary terms. According to the strongly grounded work of the War Resisters League, more than 50% of the federal budget outlays go into the military, as opposed to a skewed government depiction of budgetary spending. Basic social structures such as education, or basic human survival needs such as food security, fall short in this picture. Alternative security paradigms. Lester Brown, president of the Earth Policy Institute, recommends a conceptual and fiscal redefinition of security. Climate change, population growth, water shortages, poverty, rising food prices, and falling states are the real security threats as opposed to military forces. While the conceptual change can be understood relatively easily, the vested interests of strong defense industries impede the fiscal implementation. Peace activist Frieda Berrigan wrote, "We have to dismantle the military-industrial complex and take the profit out of security. Catalyze a transformation of thinking so that security means more than bombs and borders and bloodletting, and begin to turn the whole work of the government around so that it serves the needs of the people rather than sating the appetites of corporations." Human security. Human security is people-centered and emphasizes physical safety, economic and social well-being, respect for the dignity and worth of human beings, protection of human rights, and fundamental freedoms. Jody Williams, who received the 1997 Nobel Peace Prize for her work to ban landmines, advocates for a human security concept, where peace is defined by human and not national security, and that it must be achieved through sustainable development, environmental justice, and meeting people's basic needs. Authentic security. Author and peace studies professor Jack Nelson Pallmeyer calls for a rejection of American exceptionalism and pretenses to domination in order to unlock our imaginations for pathways to authentic security. Nelson Pallmeyer goes on to distinguish between authentic security and protection of interests. Authentic security is based on the idea that leaders take steps to keep families, homes, neighborhoods, and nations safe and secure. Protection of interests, on the other hand, is based on the idea that leaders represent the interests of the wealthy, that our nation has special rights and responsibilities, and that there are many consumptive wants and needs. The second idea is supported by offensive militarism. Militarism is not defense. Defending interests isn't the same thing as defending legitimate security needs. Human needs. John Burton contributed to the field of conflict resolution with his concept based on the human needs theory. His idea was that every person or group has basic needs, and if these needs are not met, the person or group is going to engage in conflict. The five needs are security, participation, autonomy, recognition, and identity. When security is a shared need by all humans, pursuing security through force will not meet everyone's basic human needs. Common security. Conflict management, as practiced in the iron cage of war, is self-defeating. In what is known as the security dilemma, states believe they can only make themselves more secure by making their adversaries less secure, leading to escalating arms races that have culminated in conventional, nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons of horrific destructiveness. Placing the security of one's adversary in danger has not led to security, but to a state of armed suspicion, and as a result, when wars have begun, they have been obscenely violent. Common security acknowledges that one nation can only be secure when all nations are. The national security model leads only to mutual insecurity, especially in an era when nation states are porous. The original idea behind national sovereignty was to draw a line around a geographical territory and control everything that attempted to cross that line. In today's technologically advanced world, that concept is obsolete. Nations cannot keep out ideas, immigrants, economic forces, disease organisms, information, ballistic missiles, or cyber attacks on vulnerable infrastructure like banking systems, power plants, and stock exchanges. No nation can go it alone. Security must be global if it is to exist at all. In its briefest form, common security means no one is safe until all are safe. The Iron Cage of War, the present war system described. When centralized states began to form in an ancient world, they were faced with a problem we have just begun to solve. If a group of peaceful states were confronted by an armed, aggressive, war-making state, they only had three choices: submit, flee, or imitate the warlike state and hope to win in battle. In this way, the international community became militarized and has largely remained so. Humanity locked itself inside the Iron Cage of War. Conflict became militarized. War is the sustained and coordinated combat between groups leading to large numbers of casualties. War also means, as author John Horgan puts it, militarism, the culture of war, the armies, arms, industries, policies, plans, propaganda, prejudices, and rationalizations that make lethal group conflict not only possible, but also likely. In the changing nature of warfare, wars are not limited to states. One might speak of hybrid wars, where conventional warfare, terrorist attacks, human rights abuses, and other forms of large-scale indiscriminate violence take place. Non-state actors play an increasingly important role in warfare, which often takes the form of so-called asymmetric warfare. While particular wars are triggered by local events, they do not break out spontaneously. They are the inevitable result of a social system for managing international and civil conflict. The war system. The capacity for war to start at all is reliant upon the war system, which prepares the world in advance for particular wars. Debunking myths of war. World Beyond War maintains a list of common war myths and the facts that debunk them. Among common war system myths are: war is inevitable. We have always had it and always will. War is human nature. War is necessary. War is beneficial. The world is a dangerous place. The world is a zero-sum game. What you have, I can't have, and vice versa, and someone will always dominate. Better us than them. And we have enemies. The war system rests in part on a set of interlocked beliefs and values that have been around so long that their veracity and utility go mostly unquestioned, although they are demonstrably false. The war system also includes institutions and weapons technology. It is deeply embedded in society, and its various parts feed into each other so that it is very robust. For example, a handful of wealthy nations produce most of the weaponry used in the world's wars and justify their own participation in wars on the basis of the damage done by weaponry they have sold or given to poor nations or groups. Wars are highly organized, pre-planned mobilizations of forces prepared long in advance by the war system, which permeates all institutions of society. For example, in the United States, not only are there war-making institutions such as the executive branch of government, the CIA, NSA, Homeland Security, and the several war colleges, but war is also built into the economy, perpetuated culturally in the schools and religious institutions, a tradition carried on in families, glorified at sporting events, made into games and movies, and hyped by the news media. Almost nowhere does one learn of an alternative. A single small example of just one pillar of the culture's militarism is military recruiting. The U.S. goes to great lengths to enlist young people in the military, calling it the service. Recruiters go to great lengths to make the service appear attractive, offering cash and educational inducements and portraying it as an exciting and romantic adventure. Never are the downsides portrayed. Recruiting posters do not show maimed and dead soldiers or blasted villages and dead civilians. In the U.S., the Army Marketing and Research Group National Assets Branch maintains a fleet of semi-trailer trucks whose highly sophisticated, attractive, interactive exhibits glorify warfare and are intended for recruiting in hard-to-penetrate high schools. The fleet includes the Army Adventure Semi and the All-Army Experience Semi and others. Students can play in simulators and fight tank battles or fly Apache attack helicopters and don Army gear for photo ops and get the pitch to join up. The trucks are on the road 230 days per year. The necessity of war is taken for granted and its destructive downside not exhibited. Photojournalist Nina Berman powerfully documented the U.S. Pentagon's self-promotion to the American public beyond the usual TV advertisements and presence at all sorts of sporting events. Attempting to ascertain the recruiting budget is nearly impossible because of the complexity of recruiting today. One would have to request and compile budgetary information on specific programs like the School Recruiting Program, JMRS, Starbase, JROTC, ASFAB, SEP, and DOD STEM, along with 100 other recruiting programs. Many of these expenditures will differ with each branch, and that does not include marketing and Hollywood censorship programs. It is unlikely that DOD knows what it spends on recruiting. While wars are often launched or continued without majority public support, wars result in part from a certain simple mindset. Governments have succeeded in convincing themselves and masses of people that there are only two responses to aggression: submit or fight. Be ruled by those monsters or bomb them into the Stone Age. Unfortunately, in the 21st century, it has become patently clear that making war does not work to create peace, as the case of the two Gulf Wars, the Afghan War, and the Syrian ISIS War clearly demonstrate. We have entered a state of perma-war. Kristen Christman, in Paradigm for Peace, suggests by way of analogy an alternative problem-solving approach to international conflict. We wouldn't kick a car to make it go. If something were wrong with it, we would figure out which system wasn't working and why. How is it not working? Does it turn on a little? Are the wheels spinning in mud? Does the battery need recharging? Are gas and air getting through? Like kicking the car, an approach to conflict that relies on military solutions does not figure things out. It does not distinguish between the causes of violence and does not address aggressive and defensive motivations. We can end war only if we change the mindset. Ask the relevant questions in order to get at the causes of an aggressor's behavior and, above all, see if one's own behavior is one of the causes. Like medicine, treating only the symptoms of a disease will not cure it. In other words, we must reflect before pulling out the gun. This blueprint for peace does that. The war system does not work. It does not bring peace, or even minimal security. What it produces is mutual insecurity. Yet, we go on. Wars are endemic. In a war system, everyone has to be aware of everyone else. The world is a dangerous place because the war system makes it so. It is Hobbes' war of all against all. Nations often believe they are victims of plots and threats by other nations, certain that the other's military might is aimed at their destruction, while failing to see their own failings, that their actions are creating the very behavior they fear and arm against, as enemies become mirror images of each other. Examples abound. The asymmetrical Arab-Israeli conflict, the India-Pakistan conflict, the American war on terror that creates ever more terrorists. Each side maneuvers for the strategic high ground. Each side demonizes the other while trumpeting its own unique contribution to civilization. Added to this volatility is the race for minerals, especially oil, as nations pursue an economic model of endless growth and addiction to oil. Further, this situation of perpetual insecurity gives ambitious elites and leaders the opportunity to hold on to political power by fanning popular fears, and it provides tremendous opportunity for profit for arms makers, who then support the politicians who fan the flames. In these ways, the war system is self-fueling, self-reinforcing, and self-perpetuating. Believing that the world is a dangerous place, nations arm themselves and act belligerently in a conflict, thus proving to other nations that the world is a dangerous place and that therefore they must be armed and act likewise. The goal is to threaten armed violence in a conflict situation in the hopes that it will deter the other side. But this fails on a regular basis, and then the goal becomes not to avoid conflict, but to win it. Alternatives to particular wars are almost never seriously sought, and the idea that there might be an alternative to war itself is almost never occurs to people. One does not find what one does not seek. It is no longer sufficient to end a particular war or particular weapon system if we want peace. The entire cultural complex of the war system must be replaced with a different system for managing conflict. Fortunately, as we shall see, such a system is already developing in the real world. The war system is a choice. The gate to the iron cage is, in fact, open, and we can walk out whenever we choose. The necessity of an alternative system. War fails to bring peace. World War I was justified as the war to end all war. But war never brings peace. It may bring a temporary truce, a desire for revenge, and a new arms race until the next war. In conventional terms, the failure rate of war is 50%. That is, one side always loses. But in realistic terms, even the so-called victors take terrible losses. The casualties and victims of war are far more than those killed by direct combat. While there is controversy among those who try to measure war casualties, we warn against underestimating the numbers of civilian casualties, as that distracts from the long-lasting human costs of war. We propose that only a more integrative view of war casualties reflects the horrendous consequences. A thorough war casualty assessment must include direct and indirect war deaths. Indirect victims of war can be tracked back to the following: destruction of infrastructure, landmines, use of depleted uranium, refugees and internally displaced people, malnutrition, diseases, lawlessness, intrastate killings, victims of rape and other forms of sexual violence, social injustice, lives that could have been saved by redirecting spending, and environmental devastation. War also victimizes in many other ways beyond killing. In June 2016, the United Nations High Commission on Refugees, UNHCR, stated that wars and persecution have driven more people from their homes than at any time since UNHCR records began. 44,400 people a day are forced to flee their homes because of conflict and persecution. A total of 68.5 million people were forcibly displaced in 2017. Some 4.5 million Iraqis have become refugees since 2003, roughly half of them outside the nation of Iraq. Roughly half of the refugees are children. We also must consider other indirect losses, including property, means of employment, interrupted education, broken families, environmental devastation, and a host of others. Only by considering such indirect war casualties and victims can the myth of clean, surgical warfare with declining numbers of combat casualties be rightly countered. Furthermore, in the late 20th and early 21st centuries, wars seem not to end, but to drag on without resolution for years and even decades without peace ever being achieved. Wars do not work. They create a state of perpetual war, or what some analysts are now calling perma-war. In the last 120 years, the world has suffered many wars, as the following partial list indicates. The Spanish-American War, the Balkan Wars, World War I, the Russian Civil War, the Spanish Civil War, World War II, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, wars in Central America, the wars of the Yugoslav devolution, the First and Second Congo Wars, Iran-Iraq War, the Gulf Wars, the Soviet and U.S.-Afghanistan Wars, the U.S.-Iraq War, the Syrian War, and various others, including Japan versus China in 1937, long civil war in Colombia ended in 2016, and wars in the Sudan, Ethiopia, and Eritrea. The Arab-Israeli wars, Pakistan versus India, and on and on. War is becoming ever more destructive. The costs of war are immense on a human, social, economic, and environmental level. 10 million died in World War I, 50 to 100 million in World War II. The war begun in 2003 killed 5% of the people in Iraq. Nuclear weapons could, if used, end human societies or even life on the planet. In modern wars, it is not only soldiers that die on the battlefield. The concept of total war carries the destruction to non-combatants as well, so that today many more civilians, women, children, old men, die in wars than do soldiers. It has become a common practice of modern armies to indiscriminately rain high explosives on cities where large concentrations of civilians try to survive the carnage. In 2017, violence cost the world $14.76 trillion, or $1,988 per person globally. This measure, provided by the Institute of Economics and Peace, the IEP, in their 2018 Global Peace Index, proves that economic losses dwarf the expenditures and investments in peacebuilding and peacekeeping. According to Mel Duncan, co-founder of the Nonviolent Peace Force, the cost for a professional and paid unarmed civilian peacekeeper is $50,000 per year, compared to the $1 million it costs U.S. taxpayers for a soldier in Afghanistan per year. War preparation and war are major contributors to the environmental crisis. In the whole of human history, there has been no era of greater environmental destruction than the present. Scientists are speaking out about the danger of undermining the life support system on which civilization depends, and the situation is worsening. We are in the midst of the greatest extinction crisis in 60 million years, unweaving the web of life by massive habitat destruction as well as toxification from 80,000 man-made chemicals for which nature has no evolutionary experience. We are in the midst of a rapidly accelerating warming of the planet due to the exponential growth of fossil fuel emissions over the last 150 years. The consequences are already being felt in deadly heat waves that have killed thousands, more frequent and severe storms that bring billions of dollars of property damage, rising sea levels that are already sending refugees toward higher ground, and which will eventually send millions seeking asylum in other countries, exacerbating conflict at the borders. Then there are melting glaciers that feed the great irrigation rivers of India and Southwest Asia, causing extreme floods and, when they dry up, severe agricultural losses, leading to food shortages as the population, nevertheless, continues to grow. Deserts are expanding and moving north, also impacting agricultural and forestry, as are disease organisms and parasites. And the CO2 from burning fossil fuels and from deforestation is acidifying the oceans and imperiling the bottom of the food chain on which millions rely for protein. Elsewhere are vast dead zones in the ocean, deprived of oxygen as a result of fertilizer runoff. And this is only a short list. Climate change, environmental degradation, and resource scarcity are contributing factors to war and violence, often increasing the likelihood of human conflict. Some talk about a catastrophic convergence of poverty, violence, biotic simplification, and climate change. While we should not isolate those factors as causal drivers of war, they need to be understood as additional and probably increasingly important elements that are part of the social, political, and historical context of a war system. Military activity, whether preparing for war or actually fighting it, accelerates these life-threatening trends. For example, military aircraft consume about one quarter of the world's jet fuel. The U.S. Department of Defense uses more fuel per day than the country of Sweden. An F-16 fighter bomber consumes almost twice as much fuel in 1 hour as a high-consuming U.S. motorist burns in a year. The U.S. military uses enough fuel in 1 year to run the entire mass transit system of the nation for 22 years. One military estimate in 2003 was that two-thirds of the U.S. Army's fuel consumption occurred in vehicles that were delivering fuel to the battlefield. The military contributes to toxifying our environment. The U.S. Department of Defense generates more chemical waste than the five largest chemical companies combined. The majority of the Superfund sites in the U.S. are on military bases. Superfund sites are EPA-designated locations where extremely hazardous waste threatens human health and the environment. During the 1991 aerial campaign over Iraq, the U.S. utilized approximately 340 tons of missiles containing depleted uranium, or DU. There were significantly higher rates of cancer, birth defects, and infant mortality in Fallujah, Iraq, in early 2010. Preparations for war degrade and destroy the ecosystems upon which civilization rests. Most Superfund sites in the U.S. are on military bases. Nuclear weapons factories like Fernald in Ohio and Hanford in Washington State have contaminated ground and water with radioactive waste that will be poisonous for thousands of years. Practicing for warfare, especially artillery practice and bombing runs, which number in the thousands each year, endanger wildlife by killing animals outright, destroying habitat, and creating stress from noise and explosions. The U.S. Navy's testing of its worldwide underwater sonar system involves powerful explosions that derange whales and other sea creatures, damaging their hearing and their own biological sonar systems. Warfighting leaves thousands of square miles of land useless and dangerous because of landmines, depleted uranium weapons, and bomb craters that fill with water and become malaria-infested. Chemical weapons destroy rainforests and mangrove swamps. The militaries of the world, and especially of the U.S., deprive nations of acutely needed resources to deal with climate mitigation, rebuilding damaged infrastructure, and ecological restoration. Hundreds of billions of dollars go into destroying things of value rather than creating useful things. Finally, all the wars and threats of war distract us from the crucial task of protecting the environment upon which our generation and future generations depend. Climate change matters for peace and security. Climate factors are already adding dimensions to social conflicts, such as in Somalia, Darfur, or Mali. The Stockholm International Peace Research Center, SIPRI, makes it clear that these risks are not future hypothetical ones, but clear, proven, and current ones. The broad categories of risk, according to SIPRI, are livelihood conditions, critical infrastructure, and migration. If we do not end war and turn our attention to the planetary crisis, the world we know will end in another and more violent dark age. The benefits of an alternative system. The benefits are no more mass killing and maiming, no more living in fear, no more grief from losing loved ones in wars, no more trillions of dollars wasted on destruction and preparing for destruction. No more pollution and environmental destruction that comes from wars and preparing for wars. No more war-driven refugees and war-induced humanitarian crises. No more erosion of democracy and civil liberties as government centralization and secrecy are rationalized by a war culture. No more maiming and dying from weapons left over from long-ago wars. The Institution for Economics and Peace, the National Priorities Project, Costs of War, the War Resisters League, the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, and others are doing invaluable work regarding the absurd burden of war costs on the public. Author Judith Hand writes, "The overwhelming majority of people from all cultures prefer to live in peace. At the deepest level of our being, people hate war. Whatever our culture, we share a desire for the good life, which most of us define as having a family, raising children, and watching them grow into successful adults, and doing the work that we find meaningful. And war grotesquely interferes with those desires." Chapter 2, Why We Think a Peace System is Possible. Thinking that war is inevitable makes it so. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Thinking that ending war is possible opens the door to constructive work on an actual peace system. There is already more peace in the world than war. The 20th century was a time of monstrous wars, yet most nations did not fight other nations most of the time. The U.S. fought Germany for 6 years, but was at peace with the country for 94 years. The war with Japan lasted 4 years. The two countries were at peace for 96. The U.S. has not fought Canada since 1815 and has never fought Sweden or India. Guatemala has never fought France. The truth is that most of the world lives without war most of the time. In fact, since 1993, the incidence of interstate warfare has been declining. At the same time, we acknowledge the changing nature of warfare as discussed previously. This is most notable in the vulnerability of civilians. In fact, the purported protection of civilians has been increasingly used as a justification for military interventions, for example, the 2011 overthrow of the government of Libya. We have changed major systems in the past. Largely unanticipated change has happened in world history many times before. The ancient institution of slavery was largely abolished within less than 100 years. Though significant new types of slavery can be found hiding in various corners of the earth, it is illegal and universally considered reprehensible. In the West, the status of women has improved dramatically in the last 100 years. In the 1950s and 1960s, over 100 nations freed themselves from colonial rule that had lasted centuries. In 1964, legal segregation was overturned in the U.S. In 1993, European nations created the European Union after fighting each other for over 1,000 years. Disagreements like Greece's recent debt crisis or the 2016 Brexit vote, Britain leaving the European Union, are dealt with through social and political means, not through warfare. Some changes have been wholly unanticipated and have come so suddenly as to be a surprise even to the experts, including the 1989 collapse of the Eastern European communist dictatorships, followed in 1991 by the collapse of the Soviet Union. In 1994, we saw the end of apartheid in South Africa. 2011 saw the Arab Spring uprising for democracy catch most experts by surprise. We live in a rapidly changing world. The degree and pace of change in the last 130 years is hard to comprehend. Someone born in 1884, potentially the grandparent of people now alive, was born before the automobile, electric lights, radio, the airplane, television, nuclear weapons, the internet, cell phones, and drones. Only 1 billion people lived on the planet then. They were born before the invention of total war. And we are facing even greater changes in the near future. We are approaching a population of 9 billion by 2050. The necessity of ceasing to burn fossil fuels and a rapidly accelerating climate shift that will raise sea levels and flood coastal cities and low-lying areas where millions live, setting in motion migrations the size of which have not been seen since the fall of the Roman Empire. Agricultural patterns will change, species will be stressed, forest fires will be more common and widespread, and storms more intense. Disease patterns will change. Water shortages will cause conflicts. We cannot continue to add in warfare to this pattern of disorder. Furthermore, in order to mitigate and adapt to the negative impacts of these changes, we will need to find huge resources. And these can effectively come from appropriating the military budgets of the world, which today amount to $2 trillion a year. As a result, conventional assumptions about the future will no longer hold. Very large changes in our social and economic structure are beginning to occur, whether by choice, by circumstances we have created, or by forces that are out of our control. This time of great uncertainty has huge implications for the mission, structure, and operation of military systems. However, what is clear is that military solutions are not likely to work well in the future. War as we have known it is fundamentally obsolete. The perils of patriarchy are being challenged. Sociologists, feminist scholars, and peace researchers identify patriarchy as a mindset and system of social organization that privileges certain masculine ways of conducting politics, structuring laws, and shaping the economic, ecological, and social relations that guide our lives. Patriarchy is rooted in the social construct of gender, the culturally defined and socially sanctioned role in human affairs played by men and women, and the characteristics attributed to each that have rationalized these roles. Patriarchy is associated with social values culturally defined as masculine, including dependence on hierarchy, control, authoritarianism, autonomy, separation, exclusion, and competition. Many feminist political scholars have observed that men's historical dominion over the public domain has shaped a social, economic, and political order dominated by these traits. War, militarization, and militarism represent the pinnacle of negative patriarchal values, thinking, and behavior. Feminist peace scholar Betty Reardon observed the strong linkage between sexism and militarism, and argued that you can't eliminate violence against women without abolishing war and eliminating militarism and the thinking and values it brings to society. The masculine bias in secure decision-making and practice limits diverse perspective considerations and narrows the repertoire of conflict resolution strategies that might be used. Feminist peace researchers are challenging the patriarchal paradigm by introducing feminist perspectives on security. These perspectives are more closely linked to human security, where interdependence, care, human rights, basic needs, and relationships are fundamental considerations. The feminist approach also takes into account the day-to-day lived reality of those impacted by violence and focuses on the more subjective private realities of human existence. Reardon argues that authentic change can only emerge from the integration of masculine and feminine perspectives, modes of thoughts, and processes for designing new systems and the education necessary to achieve them. This is the intention behind many of the political strategies called forth within the UN system that mandate the inclusion of a gender perspective in security decision-making and peace-building. Patriarchy is so imbued into our system of security that it appears to be natural. The good news is that gender is a social construct. It is not biologically determined. Gender roles and expectations are fluid and dynamic, varying across cultures and changing over time. Critical examination of gendered stereotypes has led to replacing outdated biases with more nuanced thinking. The binary gender categories of our past are beginning to blur. If an era of enlightenment is at hand, we must be willing to alter our attitudes. More fluid gender identities are emerging. And that is a positive step. Recent research has shown that greater gender equality in politics and business within a state is equated with lower rates of direct violence. Consequently, a larger gender gap is a good predictor of a state's propensity to engage in violent conflict. Many other positive trends are showing that patriarchy can be successfully challenged. Microloans are empowering women in countries with histories of misogyny. Educating girls is correlated with lowering birth rates and raising standards of living. Female genital mutilation is being discussed and challenged in areas of the globe where male control has always been the standard operating procedure. Women are playing greater roles in designing peace-building processes. And as of January of 2018, full gender parity was achieved in the upper levels of leadership within the United Nations for the first time. 23 of the 44 members of the Secretary General's senior management group are now women. This follows the precedent set by Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau in his choosing to govern with a gender-balanced cabinet. We should consider mandating internationally in all governments the same parity, not only for all elected offices, but all civil servant positions. The progress on women's rights is substantial. Achieving full equality with males will yield healthier, happier, and more robust societies. Compassion and cooperation are part of the human condition. The war system is based on the false belief that competition and violence are the result of evolutionary adaptations, a misunderstanding of a popularization of Darwin in the 19th century that pictured nature as red in tooth and claw, and human society as a competitive zero-sum game where success went to the most aggressive and violent. But advances in behavioral research and evolutionary science show that we are not doomed to violence by our genes, that sharing and empathy also have a solid evolutionary basis. Since the Seville Statement on Violence was released in 1986, which refuted the notion of innate and inescapable aggression as the core of human nature, there has been a revolution in behavioral science research which overwhelmingly confirms that earlier declaration. Humans have a powerful capacity for empathy and cooperation, which military indoctrination attempts to blunt with less than perfect success, as the many cases of post-traumatic stress syndrome and suicides among returning soldiers testify. While it is true that humans have a capacity for aggression as well as cooperation, modern war does not arise out of individual aggression. It is a highly organized and structured form of learned behavior that requires governments to plan for it ahead of time and to mobilize the whole society in order to carry it out. The bottom line is that cooperation and compassion are as much a part of the human condition as is violence. We have the capacity for both and the ability to choose either. But while making this choice on an individual psychological basis is important, it must lead to a change in social structures. The importance of structures of war and peace. It is not enough for the world's people to want peace. Most people do, but nonetheless support a war when their nation state or ethnic group calls for it. Even passing laws against war, such as the creation of the League of Nations in 1920 or the famous Kellogg-Briand Pact of 1928, which outlawed war and was signed by the major nations of the world and never formally repudiated, were always understood by their creators as components of necessarily broader systemic changes needed to end war. Both of these laudable moves were created within a robust war system and by themselves could not prevent further wars. Creating the League and outlawing war were necessary, but not sufficient. What is sufficient is to create a robust structure of social, legal, and political systems that will achieve and maintain an end to war. The war system is made up of such interlocked structures which make war normative. Therefore, an alternative global security system to replace it must be designed in the same way. Fortunately, such a system has been developing for over a century. An alternative system is already developing. As previously mentioned, evidence from archaeology and anthropology now indicate that warfare was a social invention about 10,000 years ago with the rise of the centralized state, slavery, and patriarchy. We learned to do war. Yet, for over 100,000 years prior, humans lived without large-scale violence. The war system has dominated some human societies since about 4000 BC. Beginning in 1816 with the creation of the first citizen-based organizations working to end war, a string of revolutionary developments has occurred. We are not starting from scratch. While the 20th century was the bloodiest on record, it will surprise most people that it was also a time of great progress in the development of the structures, values, and techniques that will, with further development pushed by nonviolent people power, become an alternative global security system. These are revolutionary developments unprecedented in the thousands of years in which the war system has been the only means of conflict management. Today, a competing system exists. Embryonic, perhaps, but developing. peace is real. By the mid-19th century, the desire for international peace was developing rapidly. As a result, in 1899, for the first time in history, an institution was created to deal with global-level conflict. Popularly known as the World Court, the International Court of Justice exists to adjudicate interstate conflict. Other institutions followed rapidly, including the first effort at a world parliament to deal with interstate conflict, the League of Nations. In 1945, the UN was founded, and in 1948, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was signed. In the 1960s, two nuclear weapons treaties were signed, the Partial Test Ban Treaty in 1963 and the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which was open for signature in 1968 and went into force in 1970. More recently, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty in 1996, the Landmines Treaty in 1997, and in 2014, the Arms Trade Treaty were adopted. The Landmine Treaty was negotiated through unprecedented successful citizen diplomacy in the so-called Ottawa process, where NGOs together with governments negotiated and drafted the treaty for others to sign and ratify. The Nobel Committee recognized the efforts by International Campaign to Ban Landmines, ICBL, as a convincing example of an effective policy for peace, and awarded the Nobel Peace Prize to ICBL and its coordinator, Jody Williams. The International Criminal Court was established in 1998 and entered into force in 2002. Laws against the use of child soldiers have been agreed on in recent decades. Nonviolence, the foundation of peace. As these were developing, Mahatma Gandhi and then Martin Luther King and others developed a powerful means of resisting violence, the method of nonviolence, now tested and found successful in many conflicts in different cultures around the world. Nonviolent struggle changes the power relationship between oppressed and oppressor. It reverses seemingly unequal relationships, as for example in the case of the Mir shipyard workers and the Red Army in Poland in the 1980s. The Solidarity movement led by Lech Walesa ended the repressive regime. Walesa ended up as president of a free and democratic Poland, and in many other cases. Even in the face of the what is considered one of the most dictatorial and evil regimes in history, the German Nazi regime, nonviolence has shown successes on different levels. For example, in 1943, Christian German wives launched a nonviolent protest until almost 1,800 imprisoned Jewish husbands were released. This campaign now is commonly known as the Rosenstrasse protest. On a larger scale, the Danes launched a 5-year campaign of nonviolent resistance to refuse to assist the Nazi war machine that saved Danish Jews from being sent to concentration camps. Nonviolent scholar Jean Sharp's Consent Theory of Power illuminates that all government power rests on the consent of the governed, and that consent can always be withdrawn. Herein lies the true power of nonviolence. As we shall see, it changes the social psychology of the conflict situation, and thus erodes the will of the oppressor to continue injustice and exploitation. It renders oppressive governments helpless and makes the people ungovernable. There are many modern instances of the successful use of nonviolence. Jean Sharp writes, "A vast history exists of people who, refusing to be convinced that the apparent powers that be were omnipotent, defied and resisted powerful rulers, foreign conquerors, domestic tyrants, oppressive systems, internal usurpers, and economic masters." Contrary to useful perceptions, these means of struggle by protest, non-cooperation, and disruptive intervention have played major historical roles in all parts of the world. Erica Chenoweth and Maria Stephen have demonstrated statistically that from 1900 to 2006, nonviolent resistance was twice as successful as armed resistance, and resulted in more stable democracies with less chance of reverting to civil war and international violence. In short, nonviolence works better than war. Chenoweth was named one of the 100 top global thinkers by Foreign Policy in 2013 for proving Gandhi right. We also now know that countries are more likely to experience the onset of nonviolent campaigns when there is a greater amount of mobilization globally. Nonviolence is contagious. Nonviolence is a practical alternative. Nonviolent resistance, coupled with strengthened institutions of peace, now allows us to escape from the iron cage of warfare into which we trapped ourselves 6,000 years ago. Other cultural developments have also contributed toward building a peace system, including the powerful movement for women's rights, including educating girls, and the appearance of tens of thousands of citizen groups dedicated to working for international peace. Disarmament, strengthening international peacemaking, and peacekeeping institutions. These NGOs are driving this evolution toward peace. Here, we can only mention a few, such as the Fellowship of Reconciliation, Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, the American Friends Service Committee, the United Nations Association, Veterans for Peace, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, the Hague Appeal for Peace, the Peace and Justice Studies Association, and many, many others easily found by an internet search. World Beyond War lists on its website hundreds of organizations and thousands of individuals from all over the world who have signed our pledge to work to end all war. Both governmental and non-governmental organizations have established peacekeeping forces, such as the UN's Blue Helmets and several citizen-based nonviolent models, such as Nonviolent Peace Force and Peace Brigades International. Likewise, faith-based institutions have developed peace and justice commissions. At the same time, there has been a rapid growth of peace research and the expansion of the field of peace education at all levels. Other factors that have helped to advance the peace system include the spread of peace-oriented religions, the development of the World Wide Web, the impossibility of global empires, too costly, the end of de facto sovereignty, the growing acceptance of conscientious objection to war, new techniques of conflict resolution, peace journalism, the growth of the global conference movement, gatherings focusing on peace, justice, the environment, and development, the environmental movement, including the efforts to end reliance on oil and oil-related wars, and the development of a sense of planetary loyalty. These are only a few of the significant trends that indicate a self-organizing alternative global security system is well on the way to development. Chapter 3. Outline of an alternative global security system. No single strategy will end war. They must be layered and woven together to be effective. Entire books have been written about them. As will be apparent, choosing a world beyond war will require us to dismantle the existing war system and create the institutions of an alternative global security system and/or to further develop them where they already exist in embryonic form. Note that World Beyond War is not proposing a sovereign world government, but rather a web of governing structures, voluntarily entered into, and a shift in cultural norms away from violence and domination. How systems work. A system is any set of interconnected and mutually reinforcing structures or patterns that together govern the functioning and direction of a given entity toward a particular purpose. In other words, systems are webs of relationships in which each part influences the other parts through feedback. Point A not only influences point B, but B feeds back to A, and so on, until points on the web are wholly interdependent. For example, in the war system, the military institution will influence education to set up Junior Reserve Officers Training Corps, the JROTC programs, in high schools. The high school history courses will present war as patriotic, inescapable, and normative, while churches pray for the troops and parishioners work in the arms industry, which Congress has funded in order to create jobs to increase their likelihood of re-election. Retired military officers will head the arms manufacturing companies and get contracts from their former institution, the Pentagon, and/or make up many of the so-called media experts on war and peace issues. The latter scenario is what is infamously called the military revolving door. A system is made up of interlocked beliefs, values, technologies, and above all, institutions that reinforce each other. While systems tend to be stable for long periods of time, if enough negative pressure develops, the system can reach a tipping point and can change rapidly. We live in a war-peace continuum, shifting back and forth between stable war, unstable war, unstable peace, and stable peace. Stable war is what we saw in Europe for centuries and now see in the Middle East since 1947. Stable peace is what we have seen in Scandinavia for hundreds of years, apart from Scandinavian participation in U.S. NATO wars. The U.S. hostility with Canada, which saw five wars in the 17th and 18th centuries, ended suddenly in 1815. Stable war changed rapidly to stable peace. These phase changes are real-world changes, but limited to specific regions. What World Beyond War seeks is to apply phase change to the entire world, to move it from stable war to stable peace, within and between nations. Components of the alternative global security system. As previously mentioned, the alternative global security system outlined here is pursued through three broad strategies. 1. Demilitarizing security. 2. Managing conflicts without violence. And 3. Creating a culture of peace. These strategies are also utilized as the organizing components of our system. The demilitarizing security component identifies the strategies and approaches necessary for demilitarizing the current system. In managing conflict without violence, we explore possible reforms to existing institutions and approaches to maintaining security and, where current options are deemed ineffective or insufficient, we propose alternative possibilities. These are the tools essential to pursuing a nonviolent approach to security. Creating a culture of peace depends upon identifying and establishing the social and cultural norms, values, and principles of peace to guide our actions and vision of a more preferred world order. These principles also function as a litmus test to assess the validity of current and alternative approaches and proposals. The development of these components are not necessarily to be pursued sequentially or separately, as advancements in one area will almost certainly have reciprocating influence in other areas. Strategies will need adjusting as we observe these influences and impacts. It should be noted that many of the approaches could easily be situated within more than one category. Their current placement reflects what we think to be the most logical and practical interrelationships. The next three chapters are dedicated to addressing these three strategies in more detail. Chapter 4, Demilitarizing Security. Executive Summary. Our approach to demilitarizing security requires a rethinking of what makes us secure and alleviating our dependence on militarized approaches. We advocate for several essential strategies to move away from dependence on military intervention as a means to security. Many of these strategies are transitionary, shifting to a non-provocative defense posture, phasing out our foreign military bases, dismantling military alliances, and ending invasions and occupations. Disarmament efforts are the backbone of this system component. Thus, we outline several rationales and strategies to support general and complete disarmament, GCD. Conventional chemical and biological weapons, weapons of mass destruction, weapons in space, drones, and the arms trade are addressed here. As the present system is so deeply entrenched in the military-industrial corporate academic complex, we also address the challenge of transitioning to a peace economy. Here, we identify strategies for economic conversion, creating a stable, just, and environmentally sustainable economy, and democratizing international monetary institutions. Our system also supports the adoption of more effective, nonviolent, demilitarized responses to terrorism. Finally, we conclude this section by highlighting the important strategy of increasing the role of women in peace and security decision-making, planning, and peace-building efforts. Strategic policy and action recommendations. 3 transitionary recommendations. 1. Advocate all countries to shift to a non-provocative defense posture that requires the immediate phasing out of foreign military bases, dismantling military alliances, and ending all invasions and occupations. 2. Encourage full compliance from all countries to existing disarmament treaties. 3. Encourage individual, group, and institutional participation in divestment campaigns. 6 transformative recommendations. 1. Make transition steps toward general and complete disarmament a fundamental requirement of all future disarmament treaties and agreements. 2. Develop comprehensive strategies for economic conversion to aid the shift from a military economy to a pro-peace, sustainable economy. 3. Assure full consideration of ecological and environmental security concerns in all security decision-making. 4. Democratize international monetary institutions. 5. Require a nonviolence first response rooted in the rule of law to all acts of terrorism. And 6. Further increase the role and participation of women in peace and security decision-making and peace-building processes, in compliance with UN Security Council Resolutions 1325 and 1820. Tom Hastings, author and professor of conflict resolution, writes, "Conflicts typical of the contemporary world cannot be resolved at gunpoint. They require not a recalibration of military tools and strategies, but a far-reaching commitment to demilitarization. Military force is necessary to keep us secure. How often have we heard this argument from well-intentioned good people? It is time to move beyond this argument and challenge the notion that military interventions should be used for the sake of peace and security. At a certain time, in a certain place, a certain group of people can be saved through a military intervention. How can we argue against that? We cannot. However, a military intervention will always make the overall situation worse, and the prospects for constructive transformation of the conflict will shrink. Moreover, while lives might be saved somewhere, additional lives will be taken. And we have to face the reality. A military intervention will always take innocent lives. A military intervention is the introduction of outside military forces into an existing conflict. This takes place through means including the introductions of weapons and arms, airstrikes, and combat troops to intervene in an armed conflict. It is the use of deadly force on a massive scale. Humanitarian military intervention, by any name, is war. And wars are, by nature, destructive. there is violence, death, and suffering. In other words, when we are talking about a humanitarian military intervention, we are talking about a complete oxymoron, declaring the intention to defend life while actually taking lives. There is no military solution. This cannot be solved militarily. The solution has to be political. We have all heard these many times. Yet, those exact same phrases are commonly used to justify wars and military interventions. It is time to follow a new path. A path that is not informed by some sort of perceived naive pacifism, but by rigorous analysis of nonviolent alternatives without a so-called military option as part of the picture. The military option needs to be taken off the table. Otherwise, all the other approaches are facing a counterforce and are directly undermined. But what about the cases when innocents are facing atrocities? We have to do something, right? Absolutely. Let us just not think that the only choices we have are either a military intervention or inaction. Consider this non-exhaustive list of 31 viable nonviolent alternatives compared to military intervention. Arms embargoes. End all military aid. Civil society support with nonviolent actors. Sanctions. Work through supranational bodies like the UN and the ICC. Ceasefires. Aid to refugees. Pledge no use of violence. Withdrawal of military. Nonviolent conflict workers. Transitional justice initiatives. Meaningful diplomacy. Conflict resolution framework. Inclusive good governance. Confront violence-supporting beliefs. Increasing women's participation in social and political life. Accurate information on facts. Separate perpetrators from support base. Ban war profiteering. Peace-building engagement. Reframe the either-or, us-them choices. Effective policing. Nonviolent civil resistance. Information gathering and reporting. Public advocacy. Conciliation, arbitration, and judicial settlement. Human rights mechanisms, humanitarian assistance and protection, economic, political, and strategic inducements, monitoring, observation, and verification, divestment, and international law. Many of the concepts are familiar. If they are not applied, it is not because they are not available, but because of artificially imposed constraints, lack of interest, or self-interest. While there are no magical solutions, we know they work. We have to look at them in terms of effectiveness versus the military intervention. And it is beyond doubt that they are more effective as short, medium, and long-term responses. Shift to a non-provocative defense posture. A first step toward demilitarizing security could be non-provocative defense, which is to reconceive and reconfigure training, logistics, doctrine, and weaponry so that a nation's military is seen by its neighbors to be suitable for offense, but clearly able to mount a credible defense of its borders. It is a form of defense that rules out armed attacks against other states. Non-provocative defense implies a truly defensive military posture. It includes radically reducing or eliminating long-range weapons such as intercontinental ballistic missiles, long-range attack aircraft, carrier fleets and heavy ships, militarized drones, nuclear submarine fleets, overseas bases, and possibly tank armies. In a mature, alternative global security system, a militarized, non-provocative defense posture would be gradually phased out as it became unnecessary. Another defense posture that will be necessary is a system of defense against futuristic attacks, including cyber attacks on the energy grid, power plants, communications, financial transactions, and defense against dual-use technologies such as nanotechnology and robotics. ramping up the cyber capabilities of Interpol would be a first line of defense in this case, and another element of an alternative global security system. Also, non-provocative defense would not rule out a nation having long-range aircraft and ships configured exclusively for humanitarian relief. Shifting to non-provocative defense weakens the war system while making possible the creation of a humanitarian disaster relief force that strengthens the peace system. Phase out foreign military bases. In 2009, the U.S. lease on an airbase in Ecuador was set to expire, and the president of Ecuador made a proposal to the U.S. "We'll renew the base on one condition, that they let us put a base in Miami." The U.S. refused their offer. The British people would find it unthinkable if their government allowed Saudi Arabia to establish a large military base in the British Isles. Similarly, the United States would not tolerate an Iranian airbase in Wyoming. These foreign establishments would be seen as a threat to their security, their safety, and their sovereignty. Foreign military bases are valuable for controlling populations and resources. They are locations from which the occupying power can strike inside the host country or against nations on its border, or possibly deter attacks. They are also frightfully expensive for the occupying country. The United States is the prime example. Having hundreds of bases in 135 countries around the world, foreign bases create resentment against what is seen locally as imperial domination. Eliminating foreign military bases is a pillar of an alternative global security system and goes hand in hand with non-provocative defense. Withdrawing to an authentic defense of a nation's border is a key part of demilitarizing security, thus weakening the ability of the war system to create global insecurity. As an alternative, some of the bases could be converted to civilian use in a global aid plan as country assistance centers. Others could be converted to solar panel arrays and other systems of sustainable energy. Current action campaigns, phasing out foreign bases. World Beyond War is playing a leadership role in the creation of a new coalition that will work in the United States and in partnership with people around the world on closing U.S. military bases outside the United States. Information about the coalition can be found at www.noforeignbases.org. Information from World Beyond War is at https://worldbeyondwar.org/bases. Dismantle military alliances. Military alliances such as the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, are leftovers from the Cold War. With the collapse of the Soviet client states in Eastern Europe, the Warsaw Pact alliance disappeared. But NATO expanded up to the borders of the former Soviet Union in violation of a promise to former Premier Gorbachev and has resulted in extreme tension between Russia and the West, the beginnings of a new Cold War, signaled perhaps by a U.S.-supported coup in Ukraine, the Russian annexation of or reunification with the Crimea, depending on which narrative prevails, and the civil war in Ukraine. This new Cold War could too easily become a nuclear war, which could kill hundreds of millions of people. NATO is a positive reinforcement of the war system, reducing rather than creating security. NATO has also taken on military exercises well beyond the borders of Europe. It has become a force for militarized efforts in Eastern Europe, North Africa, and the Middle East. End invasions and occupations. The occupation of one people by another is a major threat to security and peace, resulting in direct, structural, and cultural violence that often prompts the occupied to mount various levels of attacks, from terrorist assaults to guerrilla warfare. Prominent examples are Israel's occupation of the West Bank and assaults on Gaza, and China's occupation of Tibet. even though the strong U.S. military presence in Germany, and even more so in Japan, some 70 years after World War II, has not resulted in a violent response. It does create resentment, as do U.S. troops in many of the 175 nations where they are now based. Even when the invading and occupying power has overwhelming military capability, these adventures usually do not work out due to several factors. First, they are enormously expensive. Second, they are often pitted against those who have a greater stake in the conflict because they are fighting to protect their homeland. Third, even victories, as in Iraq, are elusive and leave the countries devastated and politically fractured. Fourth, once in, it's hard to get out, as the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan exemplifies, an invasion which officially ended in December 2014 after 13 years, although almost 10,000 U.S. troops remain in country. Finally, and foremost, invasions and armed occupations against resistance kill more civilians than resistance fighters and create millions of refugees. Invasions are outlawed by the UN Charter, unless they are in retaliation for a prior invasion, which we argue is an inadequate and immoral provision. The presence of troops of one country inside another, with or without an invasion, destabilizes global security and makes conflicts more likely to be militarized and would be prohibited in an alternative global security system. Disarmament. Disarmament is an obvious step leading toward a world beyond war. The problem of war is in great measure a problem of wealthy nations flooding poor nations with weapons, most of them for a profit, others for free. Regions of the world that we think of as war-prone, including Africa and most of Western Asia, do not manufacture most of their own weapons. They import them from distant wealthy nations. International small arms sales in particular have skyrocketed in recent years, tripling since 2001. The United States is the world's leading weapons seller. Most of the rest of international weapons sales come from the four other permanent members of the United Nations Security Council, plus Germany. If these six countries stopped dealing weapons, global disarmament would be a very long way toward success. The violence of poor countries is often used to justify war and arms sales in wealthy countries. Many wars have U.S.-made weapons on both sides. Some have U.S.-trained and armed proxies on both sides, as has been the case lately in Syria, where troops armed by the Department of Defense have fought troops armed by the CIA. The typical response is not disarmament, but more armament, more weapons gifts and sales to proxies, and more arms purchases in the wealthy nations. The United States is not just the biggest arms seller, but also the biggest arms buyer. Were the United States to scale back its arsenal, removing various weapons systems that lack a defensive purpose, for example, a reversed arms race might be kickstarted. Efforts to end war are crippled by the ongoing existence and growth of the arms trade. But scaling back and ending the arms trade is a possible path toward ending war. Strategically, this approach has some possible advantages. For example, opposing U.S. weapons sales to Saudi Arabia or gifts to Egypt or Israel does not require a confrontation with U.S. patriotism in the way that opposing U.S. wars does. Instead, we can confront the arms trade as the global health threat that it is. Disarmament will require reductions in so-called conventional weapons as well as nuclear and other weapon types. We will need to end profiteering in arms trading. We will need to restrain the aggressive pursuit of global dominance that leads other nations to acquire nuclear weapons as deterrents. But we will also need to take on disarmament step by step, eliminating particular systems such as armed drones, nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons, and weapons in outer space. Conventional weapons. The world is awash in armaments, everything from automatic weapons to battle tanks and heavy artillery. The flood of arms contributes both to the escalation of violence in wars and to the dangers of crime and terrorism. It aids governments that have committed gross human rights abuses, creates international instability, and perpetuates the belief that peace can be achieved by guns. The United Nations Office for Disarmament Affairs, UNODA, is guided by the vision of promoting global norms of disarmament and oversees efforts to deal with weapons of mass destruction, conventional arms, and the arms trade. The office promotes nuclear disarmament and non-proliferation, strengthening of the disarmament regimens in respect to other weapons of mass destruction, including chemical and biological weapons, and disarmament efforts in the area of conventional weapons, especially landmines and small arms, which are the weapons of choice in contemporary conflicts. Outlaw the arms trade. Arms manufacturers have lucrative government contracts and are even subsidized by them and also sell on the open market. The U.S. and others have sold billions in arms into the volatile and violent Middle East. Sometimes the arms are sold to both sides in a conflict, as in the case of Iraq and Iran, and the war between them that killed between 600,000 and 1,250,000, based on scholarly estimates. Sometimes weapons end up being used against the seller or its allies, as in the case of weapons the U.S. provided to the Mujahideen, which ended up in the hands of Al-Qaeda, and the arms the U.S. sold or gave to Iraq, which ended up in the hands of ISIS during its 2014 invasion of Iraq. The international trade in death-dealing weapons is huge, over $70 billion per year. The main exporters of arms to the world are the powers that fought in World War II. In order, U.S., Russia, Germany, France, and the United Kingdom. The U.N. adopted the Arms Trade Treaty, ATT, on April 2, 2013. It does not abolish the international arms trade. The treaty is an instrument establishing common international standards for the import, export, and transfer of conventional arms. It entered into force in December 2014. In the main, it says the exporters will monitor themselves to avoid selling arms to terrorists or rogue states. The U.S., which has not ratified the treaty, nonetheless made certain that it had a veto over the text by demanding that consensus govern the deliberations. The U.S. demanded that the treaty leave huge loopholes so that the treaty will not unduly interfere with our ability to import, export, or transfer arms in support of our national security and foreign policy interests. And the international arms trade is a legitimate commercial activity, and otherwise lawful commercial trade in arms must not be unduly hindered. Further, there is no requirement for reporting on or marking and tracing of ammunition or explosives, and there will be no mandate for an international body to enforce an ATT. An alternative security system requires a major level of disarmament in order for all nations to feel safe from aggression. The UN defines general and complete disarmament as the elimination of all weapons of mass destruction, coupled with the balanced reduction of armed forces and conventional armaments, based on the principle of undiminished security of the parties, with a view to promoting or enhancing stability at a lower military level, taking into account the need of all states to protect their security. This definition of disarmament seems to have holes large enough to drive a tank through. A much more aggressive treaty with dated reduction levels is required, as well as an enforcement mechanism. The treaty appears to do more than require states' parties to create an agency to oversee arms exports and imports, and to determine if they think the arms will be misused for such activities as genocide or piracy, and to report annually on their trade. It does not appear to do the job, since it leaves the control of the trade up to those who want to export and import. A far more vigorous and enforceable ban on the export of arms is necessary. The arms trade needs to be added to the International Criminal Court's list of crimes against humanity, and enforced in the case of individual arms manufacturers and traders, and by the Security Council, in its mandate to confront violations of international peace and security in the case of sovereign states as the selling agents. End the use of militarized drones. Drones are pilotless aircraft, as well as submarines and other robots, maneuvered remotely from a distance of thousands of miles. Thus far, the main deployer of military drones has been the United States. Predator and Reaper drones carry rocket-propelled high-explosive warheads which can be targeted on people. They are maneuvered by pilots sitting at computer terminals in Nevada and elsewhere. These drones are regularly used for so-called targeted killings against people in Pakistan, Yemen, Afghanistan, Somalia, Iraq, and Syria. The justification for these attacks, which have killed hundreds of civilians, is the highly questionable doctrine of anticipatory defense. The U.S. president has determined that he can, with the aid of a special panel, order the death of anyone deemed to be a terrorist threat to the U.S., even U.S. citizens, for whom the Constitution requires due process of law, conveniently ignored in this case. In fact, the U.S. Constitution requires respect of the rights of all, not just U.S. citizens, as we are commonly taught. And among the targeted are people never identified, but deemed suspicious by their behavior, a parallel to racial profiling by domestic police. The Bureau of Investigative Journalism has been tracking U.S. drone strikes around the world. There is little surprise that their numbers are significantly greater than official U.S. accounts. Statistics as of July 2018 are 4,926 minimum confirmed strikes, between 7,700 and 11,000 people total killed. Civilians killed, 750 to 1,500. Children killed, between 250 and 350. The percentage of civilians killed is 20 to 40% children. The problems with drone attacks are legal, moral, and practical. To begin with, they are a clear violation of every nation's laws against murder. Additionally, they violate U.S. law, issued as executive orders under President Gerald Ford and President Ronald Reagan, outlawing assassinations by the U.S. government. Used against U.S. citizens or anyone else, these killings violate the rights of due process under the U.S. Constitution. And while current international law under Article 51 of the UN Charter legalizes self-defense in the case of an armed attack, drones nevertheless appear to violate international law as well as the Geneva Conventions. While drones might be considered legally used in a combat zone in a declared war, the U.S. has not declared war in all of the countries where it kills with drones, nor are any of its current wars legal under the UN Charter or the Kellogg-Briand Pact, nor is it clear what makes certain wars declared, as the U.S. Congress has not declared war since 1941. First, the doctrine of anticipatory defense, which states that a nation can legitimately use force when it anticipates that it might be attacked, is questioned by many international law experts. The problem with such an interpretation of international law is its ambiguity. How does a nation know for certain that what another state or non-state actor says and does would truly lead to an armed attack? In fact, any would-be aggressor could actually hide behind this doctrine to justify its aggression. At the least, it could be, and is presently, used indiscriminately without oversight by Congress or the United Nations. Second, drone attacks are clearly immoral even under the conditions of a just war doctrine, which stipulates that non-combatants are not to be attacked in warfare. Many of the drone attacks are not targeted on known individuals whom the government designates as terrorists, but simply against gatherings where such people are suspected to be present. Many civilians have been killed in these attacks, and there is evidence that on some occasions, when rescuers have gathered at the site after the first attack, a second strike has been ordered to kill the rescuers. Many of the dead have been children. Third, drone attacks are counterproductive. While purporting to kill enemies of the U.S., a sometimes dubious claim, they create intense resentment for the U.S. and are easily used in recruiting new terrorists. Further, by arguing that its drone attacks are legal even when war has not been declared, the U.S. provides justification for other nations or groups to claim legality when they may well want to use drones to attack the U.S. Drone attacks make a nation that uses them less rather than more secure. More than 70 nations now possess drones, and more than 50 countries are developing them. The rapid development of the technology and production capacity suggests that almost every nation will be able to have armed drones within a decade. Some war system advocates have said that the defense against drone attacks will be to build drones that attack drones, demonstrating the way in which war system thinking typically leads to arms races and greater instability, while widening the destruction when a particular war breaks out. Outlawing militarized drones by any and all nations and groups would be a major step forward in demilitarizing security. Phase-out weapons of mass destruction. Weapons of mass destruction are a powerful positive feedback to the war system, strengthening its spread and ensuring that wars that do occur have the potential for planet-altering destruction. Nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons are characterized by their ability to kill and maim enormous numbers of people, wiping out whole cities and even whole regions with indescribable destruction. Nuclear weapons are a threat to humanity and life on the planet. Recent years have been full of worry and hope. On the one hand, in 2017, we witnessed how 122 United Nations non-nuclear member states adopted a new legally binding treaty on the prohibition on nuclear weapons. As of July 2018, the treaty has been signed by 59 countries and ratified by 14. 50 countries are required to ratify the treaty for it to enter into force. On the other hand, we are witnessing heightened tensions between nuclear-armed nations, most notably the escalatory moves and counter-moves between the U.S. and North Korea, the U.S. backing out of the nuclear deal with Iran, and the deteriorating relationship between the U.S. and Russia. The U.S. and Russia have some 14,000 of the 15,000 nuclear bombs on the planet, with more than 2,000 in each country pointed at each other's major cities ready to fire in 5 minutes. We need advocacy and pressure on all levels against further short-term escalations, as well as long-term engagement on controlling weapons in space, ending NATO expansion to Russia's borders, removing U.S. missiles from Romania and Poland, and reinstituting the 1972 anti-ballistic missile treaty the U.S. had with the USSR, and which George Bush walked out on in 2001. Only then will we be able to create the negotiating conditions that would support the abolition of nuclear weapons once and for all. The new ban treaty fills a significant gap in international law, prohibiting nations from developing, testing, producing, manufacturing, transferring, possessing, stockpiling, using, or threatening to use nuclear weapons, or allowing nuclear weapons to be stationed on their territory. It also prohibits them from assisting, encouraging, or inducing anyone to engage in any of these activities. no nuclear weapon states or nuclear umbrella states in the U.S. nuclear alliance joined the treaty. The banned treaty is expected to stigmatize the bomb and put pressure not only on the nuclear weapon states, but on the governments sheltered under the U.S. nuclear umbrella, which rely on nuclear weapons for deterrence. Additionally, the U.S. stations about 400 nuclear bombs in NATO states, Belgium, the Netherlands, Italy, Germany, and Turkey, who will also be pressured to give up their nuclear sharing arrangements and sign the ban treaty. A Don't Bank on the Bomb campaign is taking advantage of the new ban treaty to promote divestment campaigns around the world from investments in nuclear weapons manufacturers. The treaty on the prohibition on nuclear weapons was long overdue, given that there already were treaties banning biological and chemical weapons. The 1970 Non-Proliferation Treaty, NPT, provides that 5 recognized nuclear weapon states, the U.S., Russia, U.K., France, and China, should make good faith efforts for the elimination of nuclear weapons, while all other NPT signatories pledge not to acquire nuclear weapons. Only 3 countries refused to join the NPT, India, Pakistan, and Israel, and they acquired nuclear arsenals. North Korea, relying on the NPT bargain for peaceful nuclear technology, walked out of the treaty using its peaceful technology to develop fissile materials for nuclear power to manufacture nuclear bombs. Indeed, every nuclear power plant is a potential bomb factory. A war fought with even so-called limited number of nuclear weapons would kill millions, induce nuclear winter, and result in worldwide food shortages that would result in the starvation of millions. The whole nuclear strategy system rests upon a false foundation. Because computer models suggest that only a very small percentage of warheads detonated could cause the worldwide shutdown of agriculture for up to a decade. In effect, a death sentence for the human species. And the trend at present is toward a greater and greater likelihood of some systemic failure of equipment or communication that would lead to nuclear weapons being used. A larger release could extinguish all life on the planet. These weapons threaten the security of everyone, everywhere. While various nuclear arms control treaties between the U.S. and the former Soviet Union did reduce the insane number of nuclear weapons, 56,000 at one point, there are still 15,000 in the world, only 1,000 of which are not in the U.S. or Russia. What is worse, the treaties allowed for modernization, a euphemism for creating a new generation of weapons and delivery systems, which all of the nuclear states are doing. The nuclear monster has not gone away. It is not even lurking in the back of the cave. It's out in the open and costing billions of dollars that could be far better used elsewhere. Since the not-so-comprehensive test ban treaty was signed in 1998, the U.S. has ramped up its high-tech laboratory tests of nuclear weapons, coupled with subcritical tests 1,000 feet below the desert floor in the Nevada test site on western Shoshone land. The U.S. has performed 28 such tests to date, blowing up plutonium with chemicals without causing a chain reaction, hence subcritical. Indeed, the U.S. under President Obama projected expenditures of $1 trillion over the next 30 years for new bomb factories and delivery systems, voted on and passed by Congress during the Trump administration, while upping the ante to include smaller, more usable nuclear weapons. These smaller bombs have the firepower of the weapons that destroyed Hiroshima and Nagasaki, killing tens of thousands of people with one bomb. Conventional war system thinking argues that nuclear weapons deter war, the so-called doctrine of mutual assurance destruction, MAD for short. While it is true that they have not been used since 1945, it is not logical to conclude that MAD has been the reason. As Daniel Ellsberg has pointed out, every U.S. president since Truman has used nuclear weapons as a threat to other nations to get them to allow the U.S. to get its way. Furthermore, such a doctrine rests on a wobbly faith in the rationality of political leaders in a crisis situation for all time to come. MAD does not ensure security against either accidental release of these monstrous weapons, or a strike by a nation that mistakenly thought it was under attack, or a preemptive first strike. In fact, certain kinds of nuclear warhead delivery systems have been designed and built for the latter purpose. The cruise missile, which sneaks under radar, and the Pershing missile, a fast-attack, forward-based missile. Serious discussions actually occurred during the Cold War about the desirability of a grand decapitating first strike, in which the U.S. would initiate a nuclear attack on the Soviet Union in order to disable its ability to launch nuclear weapons by obliterating command and control, beginning with the Kremlin. Some analysts wrote about winning a nuclear war in which only a few tens of millions would be killed, nearly all civilians. Nuclear weapons are patently immoral and insane. Even if they are not used deliberately, there have been numerous incidents where nuclear weapons carried in airplanes have crashed to the ground, fortunately only spewing some plutonium on the ground, but not going off. In 2007, six U.S. missiles carrying nuclear warheads were mistakenly flown from North Dakota to Louisiana, and the missing nuclear bombs were not discovered for 36 hours. There have been reports of drunkenness and poor performance by servicemen posted in underground silos responsible for launching U.S. nuclear missiles, poised on hair trigger alert and pointed at Russian cities. The U.S. and Russia each have thousands of nuclear missiles primed and ready to be fired at each other. A Norwegian weather satellite went off course over Russia and was almost taken for an incoming attack until the last minute, when utter chaos was averted. Nuclear weapons-free zones hold some promise for denuclearization. These zones are defined by the United Nations as an agreement which a group of states has freely established by treaty or conventions that bans the use of nuclear weapons in a given area, has mechanisms for verification and control to enforce its obligations, and is recognized by the United Nations General Assembly. Zones were first developed over the Antarctic region, space, and Latin America and the Caribbean. Today, they are six land zones, which cover 56% of the Earth under such treaty, thus 60% of the 195 states on Earth. There are now efforts to develop a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Korea Peninsula, and the United Nations General Assembly has urged the establishment of a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East. In the Middle East, such a treaty would cover nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons and be called a weapons of mass destruction free zone. Biological weapons consist of deadly natural toxins such as Ebola, typhus, smallpox, and others that have been altered in the lab to be super virulent, so there is no antidote. Their use could start an uncontrolled global epidemic. Therefore, it is critical to adhere to existing treaties that already make up part of an alternative global security system. The Convention on the Prohibition of the Development, Production, and Stockpiling of Bacteriological and Toxin Weapons and on their Destruction was opened for signatures in 1972 and went into force in 1975 under the aegis of the United Nations. It prohibits the 170 signatories from possessing, developing, or stockpiling these weapons. However, it lacks a verification mechanism and needs to be strengthened by a rigorous challenge inspection protocol. That is, any state can challenge another which has agreed in advance to an inspection. The Convention on the Prohibition of the Development, Production, Stockpiling, and Use of Chemical Weapons and on Their Destruction prohibits the development, production, acquisition, stockpiling, retention, transfer, or use of chemical weapons. States signatories have agreed to destroy stockpiles of chemical weapons they may hold and any facilities which produced them, as well as any chemical weapons they abandoned on the territory of other states in the past, and to create a challenge verification regimen for certain toxic chemicals and their precursors in order to assure that such chemicals are only used for purposes not prohibited. The convention entered into force on April 29, 1997. Whereas the world's stockpiles of chemical weapons have been dramatically reduced, complete destruction is still a distant goal. The treaty was successfully implemented in 2014 when Syria turned over its stockpiles of chemical weapons. The decision to pursue that result was made by U.S. President Barack Obama shortly after he reversed his decision to launch a major bombing campaign over Syria. The nonviolent disarmament measure, serving as something of a public substitute for a war measure, prevented largely by public pressure. Several countries have developed plans and even hardware for warfare in outer space, including ground-to-space and space-to-space weapons to attack satellites, and space-to-ground weapons, including laser weapons, to attack Earth installations from space. In 2005, George W. Bush encouraged the development of an Air Force program called Rods from God, a hypothetical system of space-based tungsten rods that could hit a city with the explosive power of an intercontinental ballistic missile. In 2018, Donald Trump doubled down and proposed creating a new branch of the United States military dedicated to securing U.S. supremacy in space. In 1997, believing it had the lead in this type of weapons R&D, former Assistant Secretary of the United States Air Force for Space, Keith R. Hall, said, "With regard to space dominance, we have it. We like it, and we're going to keep it." The dangers of placing weapons in outer space are obvious, especially in the case of nuclear weapons or advanced technology weapons. 130 nations now have space programs, and there are 3,000 operational satellites in space. The dangers include undermining existing weapons conventions and starting a new arms race. If such a space-based war were to occur, the consequences would be terrifying for Earth's inhabitants, as well as risking the dangers of the Kessler syndrome, a scenario in which the density of objects in low Earth orbit is high enough that attacking some of those objects would start a cascade of collisions, generating enough space debris to render space exploration or even the use of satellites infeasible for decades, possibly generations. The 1967 Outer Space Treaty was reaffirmed in 1999 by 138 nations, with only the U.S. and Israel abstaining. It prohibits weapons of mass destruction in space and the construction of military bases on the moon, but leaves a loophole for conventional laser and high-energy particle beam weapons. The United Nations Committee on Disarmament has struggled for years to get consensus on a treaty banning these weapons, but has been continually blocked by the United States. A weak, non-binding, voluntary code of conduct has been proposed, but the U.S. is insisting on a provision in this third version of the code of conduct that, while making a voluntary promise to refrain from any action which brings about directly or indirectly damage or destruction of space objects, qualifies that directive with the language, "unless such action is justified." Justification is based on the right of self-defense that is built into the UN Charter. Such a qualification renders even a voluntary agreement meaningless. A more robust treaty banning all weapons in outer space is a necessary component of an alternative global security system. Establish a peace economy. Realign military spending. Demilitarizing security, as described above, will eliminate the need for many weapons programs and military bases, providing an opportunity for government and military-dependent corporations to switch these resources to creating genuine wealth. It can also reduce the tax burden on society and create more jobs. In the U.S., for every $1 billion spent in the military, more than twice the number of jobs at wider spectrum of pay grades would be created if the same amount were spent in the civilian sector. The trade-offs from shifting federal spending priorities with U.S. tax dollars away from the military toward other programs are tremendous. The United States spends $1.3 trillion annually on the Pentagon budget, nuclear weapons in the Energy Department budget, Veterans Services, the CIA, and Homeland Security. The world as a whole spends over $2 trillion. Numbers of this magnitude are hard to grasp. Note that 1 million seconds equals 12 days. 1 billion seconds equals 32 years. And 1 trillion seconds equals 32,000 years. And yet the highest level of military spending in the world was unable to prevent the 9/11 attacks, halt nuclear proliferation, end terrorism, or suppress resistance to occupations in the Middle East. No matter how much money is spent on war, it does not work. Military spending is also a serious drain on a nation's economic strength, as pioneering economist Adam Smith pointed out. Smith argued that military spending is economically unproductive. Decades ago, economists commonly used military burden almost synonymously with military budget. Currently, military industries in the U.S. receive more capital investment from the state than all other private industries combined. Transferring this investment capital to the free market sector, either directly by grants for conversion or by lowering taxes or paying down the national debt with its huge annual interest payments, would inject a huge incentive for economic development. A security system combining the elements described above, and to be described in following sections, would cost a fraction of the present U.S. military budget and would underwrite a process of economic conversion. Furthermore, it would create more jobs. $1 billion of federal investment in the military creates 11,200 jobs, whereas the same investment in clean energy technology would yield 16,800, in healthcare, 17,200, and in education, 26,700 jobs. Economic conversion requires changes in technology, economics, and the political process for shifting from military to civilian markets. It is the process of transferring the human and material resources used to make one product to the making of a different one. For example, converting from building missiles to building light rail cars. This type of conversion is feasible. Private industry does it all the time. Converting the military industry to making products of use value to society would add to the economic strength of a nation instead of detracting from it. Resources presently employed in making weapons and maintaining military bases could be redirected to many areas of domestic investment and foreign aid. Infrastructure is always in need of repair and upgrading, including transportation infrastructure such as roads, bridges, and rail networks, as well as energy grids, schools, water and sewer systems, and renewable energy installations. Just imagine how the billions spent on militarism could be reallocated to assist cities like Flint, Michigan, and Hoosick Falls, New York, where citizens, many of them poor minorities, are poisoned with lead-contaminated water. Another investment area is innovation leading to reindustrialization of economies that are overloaded with low-paying service industries and far too dependent on debt payments and foreign imports of goods, a practice that also adds to the carbon loading of the atmosphere. Air bases, for example, could be converted to affordable housing developments, entrepreneur incubators, solar panel factories, or solar panel arrays. The main obstacles to economic conversion, apart from the corruption of government by money, are the fear of job loss and the need to retrain both labor and management. Jobs will need to be guaranteed by the state while the retraining takes place, or other forms of compensation must be paid to those currently working in the military industry in order to avoid major unemployment during the transition from a war to a peacetime status. To be successful, conversion needs to be part of a larger political program of arms reduction. It will require national-level meta-planning and financial assistance, as well as intensive local planning as communities with military bases envision transformation and corporations determine what their new niche can be in the free market. This will require tax dollars, but in the end, will save far more than is invested in redevelopment as states end the economic drain of military spending and replace it with profitable peacetime economies creating useful consumer goods. Attempts have been made to legislate conversion, such as the Nuclear Disarmament and Economic Conversion Act of 1999, which links nuclear disarmament to conversion. A press conference announcing the bill observed, "The bill would require the United States to disable and dismantle its nuclear weapons and to refrain from replacing them with weapons of mass destruction once foreign countries possessing nuclear weapons enact and execute similar requirements. The bill also provides that the resources used to sustain our nuclear weapons program be used to address human and infrastructure needs such as housing, health care, education, agriculture, and the environment. So I would see a direct transfer of funds. Legislation of this sort requires more public support to pass. Success may grow from a smaller scale. The state of Connecticut has created a commission to work on transition. Other states and localities may follow Connecticut's lead. Some momentum for this grew out of a misperception that military spending was being reduced in Washington. We need to either prolong that misperception, make it a reality, obviously the best choice, or persuade local and state governments to take the initiative anyway. The economics of war prevention. The costs of war are obviously too expensive. Dr. Cilla Elworthy developed a compelling business plan to build a world without war. $2 billion over 10 years for peace is not some abstract aspirational goal for humanity, but a sound business plan. These costs dwarf the $1.686 billion of estimated global military expenditure every year, or the $14.3 trillion of global economic impact of violence. The core of the plan evolves around 25 principles on the local, national, and global levels, supported by examples and specific implementation plans. Quantifying the costs of alternatives to war in this kind of itemized overview is groundbreaking. Create a stable, fair, and sustainable global economy. War and economic and environmental injustice are tied together in many ways, not the least of which is high youth unemployment in volatile regions such as the Middle East, where it creates a seedbed for growing extremists. And the global oil-based economy is an obvious cause of militarized conflict and imperial ambitions to project power and protect U.S. access to foreign resources. The imbalance between the affluent northern economies and the poverty of the global south can be righted by a global aid plan that takes into account the need to conserve ecosystems upon which economies rest and to democratize the international economic institutions, including the World Trade Organization, the International Monetary Fund, and the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development. Models for various kinds of divestment campaigns have been and are being developed around fossil fuels, nuclear weapons, and the Israeli occupation of Palestine. There may be new opportunities to advance nuclear divestment as the new treaty banning nuclear weapons possession comes into being. A key step toward abolishing all war will be divestment from all weapons of war. World Beyond War has initiated campaigns to divest public government dollars from the biggest war profiteers. While governments buy weapons, market weapons to other governments, donate weapons to other governments, and bestow tax breaks on weapons dealers, there is another less visible way in which public money sustains weapons dealing. Public pension and retirement funds are invested, directly and indirectly, in weapons companies. Teachers and other public servants, whose interests ought to lie with promoting human needs, have their retirement security tied up with maintaining or enlarging the war industry. Keys to divesting this funding are research and lobbying, with lobbying understood to mean all forms of public education and nonviolent activism. A hub for World Beyond War's work on this is found at http://worldbeyondwar.org/divest. Political economist Lloyd Dumas states that a militarized economy distorts and ultimately weakens society. He outlines the three basic principles of a peacekeeping economy. These are, number one, establish balanced relationships. Everyone gains benefit at least equal to their contribution, and there is little incentive to disrupt the relationship. Example, the European Union. They debate, there are conflicts, but there are no threats of a war within the EU. Number two, emphasize development. Most of the wars since World War II have been fought in developing countries. Poverty and missing opportunities are breeding grounds for violence. Development is an effective counterterrorism strategy, as it weakens the support network for terrorist groups, which often recruit young, uneducated males in urban areas. And number three, minimize ecological stress. The competition for non-renewable resources, stress-generating resources, most notably oil and water, generates dangerous conflicts between nations and groups within nations. It is proven that war is more likely to happen where there is oil. Using natural resources more efficiently, developing and using non-polluting technologies and procedures, and shifting toward qualitative rather than quantitative economic growth can reduce ecological stress. Democratize international economic institutions. The global economy is administered, financed, and regulated by three institutions: the World Trade Organization, WTO, the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, IBRD, World Bank. The problem with these bodies is that they are typically undemocratic and favor the rich nations against the poorer nations, unduly restrict environmental and labor protections, and lack transparency, discourage sustainability, and encourage resource extraction and dependence. The unelected and unaccountable governing board of the WTO can override the labor and environmental laws of nations, rendering the populace vulnerable to exploitation and environmental degradation with its various health implications. Sharon Delgado, author and director of Earth Justice Ministries, writes, "The current form of corporate-dominated globalization is escalating the plunder of Earth's riches, increasing the exploitation of workers, expanding police and military repression, and leaving poverty in its wake. Globalization itself is not the issue. It's free trade. The complex of government elites and transnational corporations that control these institutions are driven by an ideology of market fundamentalism, or free trade, a euphemism for one-sided trade in which wealth flows from the poor to the rich. The legal and financial systems that these institutions create and enforce allow for the export of industry to havens of pollution in countries that oppress workers who attempt to organize for decent wages, health, safety, and environmental protections. The manufactured goods are exported back to developed countries as consumer goods. The costs are externalized to the poor and the global environment. As the less developed nations have gone deeply into debt under this regime, they are required to accept IMF austerity plans, which destroy their social safety nets, creating a class of powerless, impoverished workers for the northern-owned factories. The regime also impacts agriculture. Fields that ought to be growing food for people are instead growing flowers for the cut flower trade in Europe and the U.S. Or they have been taken over by elites, the subsistence farmers shoved out, and they grow corn or raise cattle for export to the global north. The poor drift into the megacities where, if lucky, they find work in the oppressive factories creating export goods. The injustice of this regime creates resentment and leads to, oftentimes, violent revolution, which in turn results in police and military repression by the state. The police and military are often trained in crowd suppression by the United States military at the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, formerly School of the Americas. At this institution, training includes advanced combat arms, psychological operations, military intelligence, and commando tactics. All of this is destabilizing and creates more insecurity in the world. The solution requires policy changes and a moral awakening in the global north. The obvious first move is to cease training police and military for dictatorial regimes. Second, the governing boards of these international financial institutions need to be democratized. They are now dominated by the industrial north nations. Third, so-called free trade policies need to be replaced with fair trade policies. All of this requires a moral shift from cheap consumerism to a sense of global solidarity and a realization that damage to ecosystems anywhere has planetary implications, most obviously in terms of climate change and a resulting climate refugee crisis leading to militarizing borders. If people can be assured of a decent life in their own countries, they will not be likely to try to immigrate illegally. Create an environmentally sustainable global aid plan. A related solution to democratizing the international economic institutions is to institute a global aid plan to achieve stabilizing economic and environmental justice worldwide. The goals would be similar to the UN Millennium Development Goals to end poverty and hunger, develop local food security, provide education and health care, and to achieve these goals by creating stable, efficient, sustainable economic development that does not exacerbate climate shift. It will also need to provide funds to assist with the resettlement of climate refugees. The plan would be administered by a new international non-governmental organization to prevent it from becoming a foreign policy tool of rich nations. It would be funded by a dedication of 2-5% of GDP from the advanced industrial nations for 20 years. For the U.S., this amount would be approximately a few hundred billion dollars, far less than the $1.3 trillion currently spent on the failed national security system. The plan would be administered at ground level by an international peace and justice corps made up of volunteers. It would require strict accounting and transparency from the recipient governments to ensure that the aid actually got to the people. Reconfigure the response to terrorism. Following the 9/11 attacks on the World Trade Center, the U.S. attacked terrorist bases in Afghanistan, initiating a long, unsuccessful war. Adopting a military approach has not only failed to end terrorism, it has resulted in the erosion of constitutional liberties, the commission of human rights abuses and violations of international law, and has provided cover for dictators and democratic governments to further abuse their powers, justifying abuses in the name of fighting terrorism. The terrorist threat to people in the Western world has been exaggerated, and there has been an overreaction in the media, public, and political realm. Many benefit from exploiting the threat of terrorism in what now can be called a homeland security industrial complex. Research shows that military action is often an ineffective and counterproductive tool for countering terrorism, as it fuels grievances of already marginalized communities, feeding into narratives employed by terrorist groups and providing these groups with new recruits. Moreover, both deployment of troops and weapons exports to another country increase the chance of attacks from terror organizations from that country. To better understand and address terrorist violence, it is necessary to analyze terrorism as a tool, like other forms of political violence, for pursuing interests in a border conflict context, and to view security or insecurity from the perspectives of those most marginalized in society. In general, a more effective strategy would be to treat terrorist attacks as crimes against humanity instead of acts of war, and to use all the resources of the international police community to bring perpetrators to justice before the International Criminal Court. It is notable that an incredibly powerful military was unable to prevent the worst attacks on the U.S. since Pearl Harbor. A professional field of peace and conflict studies scholars and practitioners is continuously providing responses to terrorism, which are superior to the so-called experts of the terrorism industry. Just consider this list of 7 immediate and 9 long-term nonviolent tactics developed by peace scholar Tom Hastings. Immediate nonviolent responses to terrorism. 1. Smart sanctions that focus on and affect elites only. 2. Mediation and negotiation. 3. Adjudication. 4. International law enforcement. 5. Nonviolent resistance to any violence. 6. Interposition. 7. Global criticism of all violence. Long-term nonviolent responses to terrorism. 1. Stop and reverse all arms trade and manufacture. 2. Consumption reduction by rich nations. 3. Massive aid to poor nations and populations. 4. Refugee repatriation or emigration. 5. Debt relief to poorest nations. 6. Education about roots of terrorism. 7. Education and training about nonviolent power. 8. Promote culturally and ecologically sensitive tourism and cultural exchanges. 9. Build sustainable and just economy, energy use and distribution, and agriculture. If we don't use these alternatives, it is not because they are unavailable, but because of artificially imposed constraints, lack of interest, or self-interest. While these solutions are not magical, they do work. We have to look at them in terms of effectiveness versus the military intervention. And it is beyond doubt that they are more effective as short, medium, and long-term responses. If we examine the case of ISIS, there are many constructive nonviolent alternatives that could be pursued, which should not be mistaken for inaction. These include an arms embargo, support of Syrian civil society, support of nonviolent civil resistance, pursuit of meaningful diplomacy with all actors, economic sanction on ISIS and supporters, closing the border to cut off the sale of oil from ISIS-controlled territories, and stop the flow of fighters and humanitarian aid. Long-term strong steps would be the withdrawal of U.S. troops from the region and ending oil imports from the region in order to dissolve terrorism at its roots. The role of women in peace and security. The role of women in peace and security has not been given the appropriate attention. Take, for example, treaties, in particular peace agreements, which are most commonly negotiated and signed in a male-dominated context by state and non-state armed actors. The context utterly misses the reality on the ground. The Better Peace Tool by the International Civil Society Action Network was developed as a guide to inclusive peace processes and negotiations. Women, according to the report, share a vision of societies rooted in social justice and equality, are an important source of practical experience about life in a war zone, and better understand on-the-ground realities. Peace processes, therefore, should not be narrowly focused security or political ones, but inclusive societal processes. This is what is called the democratization of peacemaking. No women, no peace. This headline described the central role of women and gender equality in the peace deal between the Colombian government and the FARC rebel group, marking the end of a 50-plus year civil war in August of 2016. The substance and the process of the peace accord reflect the contributions of women. A gender subcommission ensured line by line that women's and LGBT's perspectives were considered. There are numerous examples of created and determined women peace activists in the secular and faith-based realms. Sister Joan Chittister has been a leading voice for women, peace, and justice for decades. Iranian Nobel Peace Prize laureate Shirin Ebadi is an outspoken advocate against nuclear weapons. Worldwide, indigenous women are increasingly recognized as powerful agents of social change. A less known but nonetheless wonderful example is the Young Women's Peace Charter, aimed at building commitment and understanding of the challenges and obstacles faced by young women in conflict-affected countries, as well as other societies within the framework of the Young Women's Peace Academy. The charter aims to spread feminism worldwide, eliminate patriarchal structures, and secure the safety for feminists, women peacebuilders, and human rights defenders. The goals are accompanied by a powerful set of recommendations which can act as a model for women in many contexts. Further examples abound. Women played a particular role in peace talks in Guatemala in the 1990s. An alliance of women coordinated peace-building activities in Somalia. In Northern Ireland, women led a political movement to enhance women's power and influence the peace agreement and peace processes there. And women are helping to forge cross-community efforts in the ongoing Israeli-Palestinian conflict. In general, women's voices help to advance alternative agendas from those usually presented by leaders in power. Giving representatives from the entire community a voice in peace and reconciliation processes after an armed conflict is essential for achieving long-term peace. In most cases, however, half of the population is routinely excluded from this process. When women are excluded from peace processes, the experiences, knowledge, and needs of half of the population are lost before the country's efforts to rebuild have even begun. Acknowledging the existing gap in the role of women in peacebuilding, advances have been made, most notably at the policy level. UNSCR 1325 in the year 2000 provides a global framework for mainstreaming gender in all peace processes, including peacekeeping, peacebuilding, and post-conflict reconstruction. At the same time, it is clear that policies and rhetorical commitments are only a first step toward changing a male-dominated paradigm. In creating a world beyond war, a gender-sensitive approach to our thinking and acting needs to be adopted. The following four strategies of engendering war prevention are required. 1. Making women visible as agents of change in preventing war and building peace. 2. Removing male bias in war prevention and peace-building data collection and research. 3. Rethinking drivers of war and peace to take gender into account. 4. Incorporating and mainstreaming gender into policymaking and practice.